This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello everyone and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Survivor 42 for Survivor Global. I'm your host Shannon Gust, here to talk about what I think we all decided was episode 8. Last week was 6 and 7. I think we're categorizing this as episode 8. I cannot check it right now on this podcast. So if the title is different, that's on me, but I'm pretty sure that's what we're doing. And I have a great guest to talk about. An interesting episode. It was a bit of a standard vote, but I think that some play styles, particularly in comparison to each other, is fascinating me. And just some of the general dynamics, I think, set up for a very interesting endgame. And we saw a lot of that in this episode. So I'm really, really excited to break it down with my friend, who's a super fan, a Survivor South Africa favorite, and my passenger for this podcast. It is a great Jacques Berger. Jacques, thank you for being here.
Hi, Shannon. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I will definitely be a passenger today. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you with Survivor with you. And yes, we've had some very volcanic and impactful episodes the last, I would say, 4 or 5 we've done. So this one is a bit more low-key. So yeah, I'm glad to see the curse has been lifted. That every time you and I talk, it's not the massive double eliminations or crazy idol plays happening.
Is that a curse? I feel like that's a gift. Like, if we're always talking and it's like some really exciting episode, that's a very good thing. Like, maybe it's a curse for the players, but we as podcasters in the audience, like, that can't be bad.
Yeah, but then I always feel like because the episode was such a high episode that I need to bring, like, my, you know, try to top that with the post-game commentary. Now, because it's a bit more low-key, we can be at low-key. So it's a good change of pace for sure.
Yeah, I don't mind the low-key episodes, especially when I'm enjoying the season, especially when I enjoy the cast and I'm fascinated by some of the play styles and the way they might be looking at the game. It's like, sometimes it's good to just check in and be like, where's everyone at? Like, what are we talking about? What are their best kind of moves forward without, like, every week needing to be some, like, huge vote that, like, takes up all the oxygen. So I'm actually still enjoying the season a lot. Still enjoyed the episode. Thank you for being, you know, getting into the car. That is this podcast. I feel like I'm just, you know, driving that home, pun intended, as much as Jeff was. I went back and I watched that scene and I felt bad because on Twitter, I kind of caught out the cast for going so high key on the car metaphors, which A, was hypocritical because I did like a long-term car metaphor in last week's podcast. And B, I noticed that when I rewatched the episode that Jeff like asked Romeo, he's like, say you're in the car. And Romeo does like not answer about the car. Like he like will not play with Jeff. So then Jeff's like, so back to the car, Chanel, and Chanel like barely touches on the car, and then like Marianne picks it up and runs with it. But I feel like he was like bullying the cast into the car analogy that at least some of them seem to not want. And I'm going to do that with you in this podcast. We're just going to be on the highway of Survivor analysis, just hanging on to down every week with the car. I don't know enough about the car.
No, we can keep rolling with the car metaphor. Back to the episodes. I think the Survivor has been, we've been to parties, we've been our places, we had 6-7 crazy days. Now in the car, driving back home, reflecting on the crazy week, you know, getting ready for the next trip. So we're in that on that transportation part of the journey. We're just slow music in the background. Everybody's a bit just like you say, reflecting. We can go with the car metaphor. I'm more than comfortable doing that.
Yes, and many listeners probably are listening to this in their cars, so that works, you know, like a lot of people listen to podcasts while driving. So hello, fellow car people in the now 2-week car analogy that we cannot get out of. I'm going to have to start learning about cars because that's clearly now a part of this job. But Jacques, before we talk about Survivor in car analogies, how are you? Tell the listeners, because you've had some big life changes recently. I won't spoil it to them, but just, you know, tell the listeners what's been going on.
Yeah, so I recently moved to London from South Africa, which has been a great change of pace. So we've been in London now for 2.5 weeks, maybe three. It's been crazy. So far I'm loving it. I'm loving the big city. I don't think I'll live in the city for 10 years, but I think 3 or 4 years, it's been amazing. There's so many places, so many things, such an eclectic, metropolitan lifestyle, which is something that I've never really experienced, which is amazing. And I think this is probably the first time that you and I have made podcast arrangements where we didn't have to spend planning around, load shedding and all of that. So that's also, also a big plus.
That's true.
Some headset issues coming in, but the first time we did it, our schedule changed a bit. I'm now 2 hours, west of where I was in Africa, but we scored on the load shedding scheduling, which is great. So yeah, no, it's been fantastic. I'm loving London.
Yes, how kind of you to move to another country so that every couple of months when we podcast, it might be slightly more convenient for me personally. I really appreciate that, Jacques. That's what you were saying about why you moved. Like that's what I got out of it.
Exactly. And there's a big underground. Underground sounds dodgy, but there's a big survivalist. There's a big
underground survivalist. What is going on with that? Betting on the results. Yeah. I mean, it sounds interesting. No, but yeah, just
I start speaking like the British. Shannon, may I interest you in a cup of tea? Would you like some water? And so, but no,
perfect accent.
Just yes, great. Yes.
So good.
Whenever I hear the British accent, I think of Jennifer Coolidge in that episode of Friends, where she goes, "Chandler, darling, you've been positively ghastly."
You should go around London talking like that, and I think people will enjoy it.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. So we've hang out with Sheldon, and Dave, and some of the other guys, Donna, and they've got this crowd like Alex and Joshua, all these like people that have I've met now through Survivor. So yeah, it's been a great platform for me to get to meet people within London, which is cool.
Yeah, British Survivor community, shout out to them. I mean, I know there's like a lot of super fans there, and like to have you move when they don't have UK Survivor players, that must be such a joy. So yeah, are you the best Survivor player in the UK? Right.
Well, I mean, Shawnee stays in the UK, right? She's played twice. She's better at the game. She's better looking. So I think Shawnee is probably the best London-based.
Shawnee moved back to Australia, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, did she move back? Okay.
Yeah. So I think by default, you are the best Survivor player in the UK of at least all the seasons I've watched, and default the two greatest words in the English language. Yeah, it was worth it. The title.
I mean, look, I know Kieran from South Africa, he and Aditi are planning to move here. They
are planning to move, and then you guys can battle over who's the best, but
I haven't played Survivor against Kieran. I've played golf against him, kicked his ass. I mean, if you are the international expert, so by default, if I am the best London the base placing, the only Survivor playing this in London, then yeah, maybe print a shirt, get a crown.
Definitely like before Kieran moves. Yeah, because Kieran, I mean, Kieran played a great game. Like that might be a bit of a battle, but then you'll be the best Survivor golfer in the UK. That'll be worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Relish this time before he comes. But Jacques, you said it was a bit more of a chill episode. I'd love to know your thoughts more broadly on how you've been feeling about the season and who's really been standing out to you.
Yeah, so far it's been a great season. I will say with us moving to London, a lot of things happening. This is probably the first season where I haven't followed any of the preseason stuff. So I came in watching the premiere was literally the only episode that I've seen of background of all the players. So I didn't have necessarily higher or lower expectations coming in, but I think from the pilot, I think this has been a great cast. I think they've got great people. I'm enjoying some of the changes the production have made. They've had the blessed to essentially play the same game twice, and then change what didn't work for him in the first instance with season 41. But yeah, I think the people are cool. I think it feels like the editing is slightly more damp life favored and getting in these personal connections, which I think is something that a lot of people felt was lacking in the previous season. So yeah, seeing that and then also having, some of those human moments, the personal stuff, which you know, some people difficult to share. You know, we think of Romeo, we think of, you know, Omar praying and Mike's watching, all those things which essentially starts conversations around, you know, normal life is something that survivors always been known to do. So in that facet of a game, I think it's also great. So yeah, the challenges have been good. The advantages, we'll get into that, I think have been well designed. I think they have done a great job of adding advantages into the game while not painting themselves into a corner from a production standpoint. And the people have just been overall fun. I don't feel like people aren't malicious. You know, there's nobody who's really like, you know, they're playing the game, they're playing to win, and that's exciting to see.
I mean, I'm wondering with the advantages for myself, like, I wonder how much the advantages are okay or how much I, as a viewer, have just been worn down over years to this, like, you know, jump in small parts. Like, we didn't start day one at nothing and then get to this in a day. Like, we've become accustomed to it through decades of evolutions of the game, and now this is what the game is. Like, I have people who are new to the show, like my cousin just started watching, and she's watching Australia, but now she's going back in some of the older seasons, and like, it's stark for her just like how strange 42 is. And for me, I feel like we've just like accepted it slowly over time. So I wonder like how much is that on us as viewers who have just kind of been like predispositioned to accept it, versus like how much of this is okay, because it is a lot. And I was thinking the other day, like, I don't know that they can sustain a 26-day format, not because I feel like the days are changing that much, but just because I feel like they feel the need to overcompensate in parts for the days with some of the hardships and like the like specific themes that they go to around that. And I feel like that's going to get pretty old, or at least just, I don't know how much they're going to want to redo things the way they've like redone 41 completely. So then there's going to be new things. They're going to be like more and more, I'll say, creative. It's going to get to be a lot. And I feel like the 26-day format, for that reason, maybe can't be sustained. So I'm just like, these are just things that I'm thinking about as like we, for some reason, get like an homage to season 41 through the season. And season 41 was pretty good. But like, is it the season that needed like, you know, this level of fan service from the show? It's kind of crazy in the end that we have like, yeah, like season 41. It's like, that's really just like, give it that honor that like almost no other season has had in the formatting of different seasons.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. One thing I will say, and that is something that, I mean, Australians are on the other side of the spectrum with, you know, them playing 54 days. But one thing that really struck me watching, specifically this episode, is when you play 39 days, I've never played the 26-day season, so it might be difficult. But hearing what I think it was Chanel or Jay, I can't remember, saying, I only know these people.
Yeah, Drea said that. Yeah,
Drea, I only know these people for 10 days, so I don't mind voting her out. Which is, I can understand from her perspective why that would be the opinion they have. But when you play, I mean, when we played, we had this massive monsoon that was, you know, we went through essentially two like hurricanes, and it was constantly raining, and there were these literally days of people just sitting in the shelter and sharing just like each other's like bodies just to get some heat, you know, just like cuddling and hugging, and that essentially forms you. And then you get like that, how we see the Sahula fight being like super tight, and the Amigos, and you see, you know, and the Nia and Amy and those guys, even where they are like, we've been through so much as a group that we will not break at this point just yet. So I think that extra day or two, just slowly, you know, spreading out the pain, makes you more prone to work with the group that you are around, whether it's, you know, your starting group or starting group of a second group. And I think that's something which very clearly in this season, the people don't have that same sentiment to the people around them.
Yeah, for sure. That's the thing I mostly want to talk about with this episode, because I feel like Drea as a character and her play style personifies for me the modern game at its most, almost self-parody. Like, literally, I mean, if you would want, like, show a confessional to people who kind of don't love modern Survivor and love the pure old school game, with her being like, I have all of these advantages, and all of the advantages are also a little ridiculous, like, let's be honest. So she personifies that, and a play style that I find fascinating and maybe even correct for the 40s, and that's what I want to talk about, as opposed to Omar, who I think, you know, is much more the classic social strategy game that we as super fans love. Like, on Know-It-Alls, they're comparing him to the game that Rob played. Like, Rob played in 2003, and it's still a super relevant game. But it's all about connections and options. And some of the things they said are so starkly compared to me that I find it fascinating. You have Drea saying, like, I haven't known these people that long, and being willing to, like, cut them down, versus Omar, who's like, oh, Mike has, like, you know, so much empathy. He could be a good long-term ally for me. And I'm like, I love that way of thinking. I love socially connecting. Like, obviously that's what I enjoy about the game. But then I'm thinking, like, as much as I love how Omar's playing, I don't know that I agree that there is a long-term, you know, there's 10 days left. There's 5 voting rounds, assuming that they don't do or die and that that hits, in which case there'd be 4 rounds of voting before they get to fire. You know, I don't know how much that is relevant for the 40s. And it's an argument I've been having with my brother for like 2 straight days around this, because I kind of feel like maybe Drea's way of thinking, if you can do it to the level of success that I feel she is the way that you can do it. And while I enjoy Omar's way of playing, like the options and the subterfuge, and they don't even know where I stand, that's fun. There's a fun balance in that that we'll talk about, but is it even relevant for like the hard playing, shorter, more advantagey game that is the 40s. That's the fascination that I have with this episode and the dynamics. So I feel like if we're talking about the modern game, Drea personifies parts of that, and we can definitely talk that through.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's you saying there's only 10 days left, you know, 5, maybe 6 voting rounds. It's bizarre to me that from day one, a lot of people have gotten advantages and you know, went to Shipley Island, got all these extra votes, extra idols, and here we are, and essentially none of them have been played. So it's very rare. It's ironic because you think because the gameplay is faster, you're a bit more prone to play with it. But I think just because it's happening at such a great speed, I might be inclined to think you don't have time to sit back and essentially strategize or plan or have these conversations and how to utilize it. Because you wake up, you get your email, you go to a challenge, you come back, it's 2 a.m. or 2 p.m., and you have to, you know, 3 hours to scramble before you need to go back to trouble and vote. So I think that, ironically, because of the pace of the game, that's why we still have so many advantages unplayed at this point in time. Maybe the players are better, but that's just my read on the situation.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting because, like, Omar's voted twice. He voted for Mariah. He voted on the second of the split. He didn't have a vote at the merge, but obviously he had influence and capital, but he's still kind of in that phase of like, all right, well, let's like make these key relationships to like play out the game. But like, what game are you playing out? Because there's a double next week. That's going to get us to 8 people. So you're going to go to 1 tribal council. Then there might be a do or die. It kind of seems like there might be, so there's going to be 8, say 7 is do or die, 6 and 5. And then next week. So that like 4 voting rounds, you would think heavily influenced by all the advantages that might be blocking up the end game. Like, how much social strategy will be relevant or able to be played in this end game for someone who has just started voting, for all of them who've voted at like a maximum handful of times, already in this game? It's just an interesting thing to think about. And I'm going to want to talk about it like basically point by point, especially for Drea and Omar, who I felt like really had those different highlights in this episode. But it's just, yeah, very fascinating in a shorter game about like what social relationships mean, how much the advantages mean over that, how much threat level matters. Like, it's just very, very different to me in the 39-day game and all of the other things that make modern Survivor, modern US Survivor, that different. It's not just the days, but it also is 3 tribes, so they all went to tribal council much, much less than the pre-merge, 1 or 2 times. And now all of those tribes are such a mess that the majority now seems like the most cohesive group and parts, or like some of the tightest relationships that they're meeting halfway through, you know, 12 days or so in. But there's only 2 weeks left of the game. And most of that, well, some of that at least won't be voting rounds, might be a do or die, will be fire for sure, will be blocked up by advantages. It's like, where is the space for the strategy and the votes actually being? So then like, how much does social capital matter to that? I've just been thinking it through, just because I feel like Drea and Omar are such interesting examples of both of those play styles. And I feel like Modern Survivor is so specific to one of them. So I'm just fascinated by it.
No, it is really fascinating. And there's another thing, it's a note here that I have, and it's something I want to talk about, but now's as good a time as any, is that we see the, it's called the advantage omelet, or whatever that Lindsay, Jay, and I got. They should have called it something like the interest advantage, because over time it gains interest. You know, it gets better and better. You know, it's like it grows over time or something like that. But whatever you want to call it. I call it in my mind when I speak about it to my, I call it the interest advantage or interest idol. But you mentioned now that we're 10 people left in the game with a double boot coming up. Okay. So then there's essentially 8 people left in the game. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's, the last time that you can use that is at final 6. So if you want, let's say you are Lindsay, okay, and you want to essentially use your idol at final 6, you then need to vote somebody out at 8 and then somebody out at 7 to make sure that your idol is valid on 6, because that's the last time when you can play it. So
yeah,
we are definitely, depending on what happens, let's say the double episode is 2 random people, then and you have those three people left, and they only have two votes left until they are their advantage. It has maximum power. We are definitely going to see them go head to head, or I mean, call a neutral truce, and just which I don't think will happen. So it's also fascinating, even though the game has this, you would think, you know, random board of random targets, because none of these, obviously all three of them have, from a production point of view, fortunately have had, or have kept their amulets, had not, and we displayed it. This deep in the game, we are sure to see them turning on one another to make sure that when there's six people left in the game, I have a guaranteed ticket to five, because that's a, you know, that's a, gives you a big impetus and a big reason to do it. So I'm very excited to see how this section of the game plays out.
Yeah, I think Drea should be triggering the amulet war pretty much around now. Definitely using them being split into groups. So if you can get some people on the outside, she has an extra vote. This is the best time to use the extra vote in those small numbers. Start triggering it, because she has the ammo to win and protect with the amulet war. So she can kind of use maybe an idol, whatever, to then gain another idol later down the track with the amulet. She does have to think about the fact that the amulet idol will expire at six instead of five. So you might want to leave a trick in the bag for sure. To get to through the five round. But I think that she should start thinking about that. And I think with Drea, as we start to kind of move to talk about her game, because I, you know, definitely think she was like a main character of the episode. What's really interesting is that she doesn't have three idols. She has one idol currently and the capacity for two more idols. And we're in a modern era where the advantages all kind of have this interesting thing about them, like, okay, so now it's public, so there's that threat level, there's a bounty on it, like things that weaken them, but having all of them protects against that. So like knowledge is power exists, so that should weaken people with advantages because you can steal it, but she gained knowledge is power, so she protects against that. And Rob and Steven were saying, oh, it's kind of like she's the most useless person to get knowledge is power because she has everything already. I'm like, no, this matters the most to her. Just defensively having knowledge is power, keeping it out of someone else's hands, even if she never used it, it would be worthwhile because she would be the prime target for someone to use it on, because she has so many trinkets. So defensively, to keep that, I think is like crucial for her game. So like having all of these things can be used to like compound each other, to activate other parts of what she has, to protect each other in ways, and to protect against the weaknesses or the holes or the publicity that modern advantages, or at least like advantages in the 40s, gives you, because she's now gained so many that like she's protecting against that. So yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's like, how do I protect against like issues with the advantages? Is like just have so many that you then cover all those holes, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. And I think what's interesting is from Jaya's perspective is, I mean, she's now, like you said, she's got all this ammunition. And we have seen sometimes when people come out with all this ammunition and then they get their way to the end, how they might be despised within their own season. You think of something like Russell Hans when he did it just, you know, idly. Right then, how people didn't like it, or when you idle somebody out of the game, they don't see it as, oh, you did a great move, you know, respect. They see it as, oh, you know, you essentially you cheated me or outplayed me, and people have, you know, love to bear a grudge on that front if you play it like that. And we've also seen, if you think of someone like Ben Dreeberger, when he played, you know, idle essentially straight to the end, how post the season within the survival realm, and when he went back for a second time, how people just didn't respect that game at all. So I'm just concerned for Drea that if she is now this person who's just every single tribal council opening the bag of tricks, coming out with this and with that and with this and that, that the people she votes out, who essentially come collateral damage to this ammunition that she has, sees that as, oh, in a not necessarily a competitive way of winning the game, or, you know, you kept on, you know, getting all these tricks, that's the only way you could win, that you know, you don't necessarily by default have respect of the jury. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking if perhaps the best move for her is not to use the knowledge is power. I mean, if you have an idol, like it's one of those things as a kid, you watch certain TV like, I want to get an idol. And not a lot of people, I mean, modern day, more people do get it, but not a lot of people have the opportunity to finally find an idol. So when you do, it feels really special as a survivor player and as a fan of a game. So to have that stolen from you because somebody's picked up another piece of parchment, although it's not their fault, I can see that the perception will be that, oh, this guy's playing a dirty game and you know, you don't respect that necessarily. So, I mean, last season they essentially had their backs against the wall, so they had to make a move against Xander and his lines. I get that. But now, if you are in a power position, I feel like it would be much better to sit at the end and say, look at all these trinkets I had. never had to play them, boom, then to say I have to use every single one of them. And this is coming from me who likes to, you know, use advantages to the optimal degree. But there is some social trade-off that you make. And I think Dre is an interesting position because we might see her playing a fantastic social game and not being able to utilize these items, which will in turn show, you know, great strength on her part. So I'm very interested to see how this plays out.
I mean, I think she needs to use knowledge as power. I think if Omar finds knowledge as power, he should never use it. That goes against everything he's trying to do, which is to help people, to build them up, to have connections. And then you've stolen an idol from someone. That's an advantage focused game. That's an anti-social move. I'm not going to go to the length of calling Drea anti-social because I think her social game is complex and we'll talk about it. There's definitely some social missteps. There's definitely some missed opportunities, but she's been socially central in every vote. Like, she's in power, and there has to be something to that, to the fact that people are drawn to her. She's brokering deals. There's definitely something socially strategic in that, and it's not just this, like, advantage game. But I think for her, like, she gave herself a framework to play by just by the person that she seems to be in her everyday life, and you have to play to who you are. She gave herself that framework episode one, and I was not on board. I was like, this is even too much for a 26-day game. And she's making me a believer that this will work for the modern game, you know, episode by episode, even if it's not necessarily something that I love in terms of a play style. If anything, it might actually kind of highlight some of the, you know, frustrations that people have with the modern game, especially if you use something like knowledge of power, which is an advantage that people don't love successfully. But I think for her, her game is in strength. It's in putting your foot on the pedal and not letting up. It's about using what you have. It's about gaining every single trinket in the game somehow. Like, she has not missed on the trinkets. And then it's about driving that home. Sorry for the, you know, I have to with the it's about, like, doing that successfully if she can. Like, now she has the weaponry, and can you use that successfully? And I really do think most modern juries will respect that. Last season, they didn't. Xander had his own kind of perception issues and the youth and everything like that. And he's very much in the Drea mold, like, to the point where, like, they both sat out of, like, the same challenge because they both didn't like the type of food and they both sat on the bench. But A, she doesn't have those perception issues. B, she's not doing it as an underdog as Xander was, which is fascinating to me. She's empowered doing it. And also, she's doing it with even more success than Xander. Like, he had this trinket game, but he still missed out on the bench advantage. She hasn't missed. She doesn't overlook one thing. Like, she has found every single thing, and some of that's been luck, and some of it has been her pushing hard to go to Shipwell Island in the first episode, get an extra vote, to find the Beware advantage. She found this here on the bench where others have missed it. It's about, to me, going to that maximum, to going to that, like, true intensity. And I don't think that her success will be pulling back in ways or being more social in ways. I think that would be, like, kind of the antithesis of how I see her as a player. Like, I see her as, like, getting the things, being extreme, and using those things to success. And that, to me, is a successful game. It probably includes winning at Fire. Like, they said for Xander as well, like, he was playing a version of that type of game, again, to less success than Drea, and with less social strategy success because he wasn't in the majority the way that she is. And even then, they were like, well, you should have used your idol on Rakan and then gone to Fire. They wanted more from that. So I think for Drea, it will be about, are you using everything at least somewhat successfully, getting to a Fire and then standing up in front of what I believe is truly most modern juries from at least, like, the late 20s, not last season, and every jury is different, but being like, this is how hard I pushed, and, like, look at the framework I gave myself and look at how I ticked every box of that framework. So I think she needs to, you know, not let up on that for 1 second.
I'm with you. And I think Drea, there was a stroke of serendipity in her game with rocks being drawn when Marianne drew the grey rock, because I think, well, let me ask this question to Shannon. If Hai drew the grey rock and she said, oh, I want to sit out, Hai, you want to swap seats with me, do you think Hai would have said yes?
I think he might have, because I don't think that, like, the bench idol is, like, iconic enough. Well, was iconic enough before the 40s and Survivor. Like, it had been done. Like, Sarah Lucina found it. But I think, like, enough people are thinking that that's something that they're necessarily hiding. Now people will fight. You know, like, everyone's going to be fighting for the bench now. But, like, I don't think before it was, like, well-known enough to be like, yeah, there's probably something there. That's not why Drea even sat out. She literally didn't want PB&J. Well, so I don't know how much people are thinking that.
No, I'm just, like, So always production will be one of two things. Either they say you draw the odd draw, you don't get picked for a team or whatever happens, and there's 11 people, it's a 5 versus 5 challenge. And then they'll say, we've got nothing for you. Sorry, you're a loser. Go sit in the corner. And then more often than not, there's something there. I mean, like you say, we saw it with, the one that Sarah got. We've seen a South Africa survivor happen where there's something there.
Yeah, but they haven't seen it. It happened with PK.
Sure.
Not more often than not. That's the thing.
What I want to say, the point that I'm trying to make is often what happens in that scenario is they will say, okay, you drew the odd draw. What you now get to do is you get to gamble on a team you think will win. And if you choose the correct team, then you get win. Then I feel like you're excluded, but you're still part of the game. So production is like they're giving you. So if they're saying you're out of it and it's by sheer random luck, they're not going to say, okay, we're drawing rocks. Two people can't participate in this challenge. Well, better luck next time. They will always have an incentive because you don't have the option to win. There will be something else for you. So I think it's, we can chat to some of the people, ask these questions to people, in post-game interviews. But I think that it's clear that there's something hidden there. And I think Drea got lucky because Mary Ann is like, I want to play. But I think there might have been, someone like Ha, or even potentially Mike, who's, thinking about the game on a bit more of or Omar, be like, well, no, it's fine. I don't like it neither. I'll just sit out. I think worked in Drea's favor.
It's such a hard expectation to put on the players. Again, for the future, people will fight for the bench. I think in this season, you wouldn't be like out of line to think like, that was the monster. I truly get nothing because so much of the season is around like,
sure,
we want you to suffer just to suffer. Like, and they send Roxroy and obviously he gets something. So you would kind of think following on from that, like the people who are left out are included in some way, but I can understand the line of thought that is also like, but also people sometimes just lose it in this format. Like sometimes they just want to punish us, and I don't hugely blame them for that because I think there's like enough precedent that I don't know. Yeah, you think of the Sarah Lucina one, but I don't think that it's like a recurring precedent in Modern Survivor. And that's also not why Drea was doing it. Like I really love the way, I love to think about the way that Drea is playing and how it works for Modern Survivor in different ways. But I would have loved it more had she been like, of course I sat out. Like, I need to look for an advantage. She'd be like, yes, Drea, that's the way you're playing. But, like, literally she hates PB&J, which is funny for a few reasons. She had a secret scene about how she's allergic to the coconut, so she's starving, which is why she sat out for the rice. So she literally just does not want the PB&J. Like, you could have had the potato chips. I found that really funny. I also found it funny that she, like, in her Drea way, will transparently say, like, that is why she's sitting out.
Yeah.
Do you think that she'd, like, offer an arm to Marianne to be like, Marianne, you seem, like, upset after the vote, and I just want you to be, like, feel part of the group and, like, have the opportunity. But she's like, I just don't want PB&J. And, like, later with the rice, like, that is why she sits out. She wants to eat. She tells us that in the secret scene. Yeah. I wanted the rice. And she's not, like, doing what some of the other people are doing, which is, like, oh, for everyone else. She's like, I need to eat. So this is what I'm saying. Like, I can't call it an antisocial game, but those are like antisocial statements, like not even to take the social opportunity to do what is social moves, like for self-interested reasons. She wants the ride. She doesn't care about PB&J, not going to expend the energy, but you think you just take the opportunity to be like, I'm doing this for you, Marianne, or I'm doing this for the tribe. And she doesn't. Like, she's such an interesting character to me. It's almost like sitcom level extreme of the type of player she is. And I know that people were confused. Like, why is she, Marianne, arguing at the last tribal council last week? Like, what is Drea's strategy? Like, that's just who Drea is. And, like, that's just who Marianne is, too. It's kind of like the connections that they've had through the season, like, both going to Shipwell Island, both being part of Beware, both being part of this exchange where, like, Marianne is, like, relentlessly joyous and Drea's, like, relentlessly blunt. The ways that those clash with each other, I find are really funny.
Yeah,
and I don't think there's more complexity to that. I think it's literally just, like, two very different people being put in the situation and interacting in these ways, which is very entertaining to me and an interesting part of Survivor. But I just think, yeah, there's so much you can speak to of Drea's character that is what, all of this is about. It's just literally just who she is.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Marianne, she is, she's just enthusiasm and excitement, and Drea is so, so stoic and calculated. It's fascinating to watch these different people play. And I think that brings back to the very first point on spoke at the beginning is the casting. I think they've done a great job of having these different people, and anybody can still win this game essentially. So yeah, it's phenomenal that we're seeing people being so on the one side. And I mean, Mary Ann, she's given that confessional, saying, you know, she was sad and crying and saying, you know, how she's on the outs and how she's been a dream to play Survivor and, you know, she's not one of the cool kids. Mm. And I mean, I can, not necessarily to the same extreme, but I can definitely understand what you're saying. Yeah. I know a lot of people sit there and they're like, well, just go out and make friends. You just stop speaking to the people. But it's extremely difficult if you don't have, and we've spoken about this before on other podcasts, but I don't want to go too deep into this, but it's very difficult if the people you're playing with don't have a lot in common to what you have. I mean, on our season, if I played with Renier and Santoni and Kieran and Chappies, four people who were, you know, academical and nerdy people, I would have had a much different game or a much different social game than playing with people like Steffi and Nicole and Rob, who are, you know, athletes and, you know, they speak about gym and exercise and training programs and, you know, a guy like Rocco, who's an athlete. So that was on our season, a lot more of those people. So it is difficult if you don't have that in common with the people to essentially get out of your comfort zone and start talking about stuff that you know nothing about. And then it just all just becomes exclusion by default, not because you don't have the skills to chat to those people. It's just you don't have that in common. And it's, I mean, it's luck of a draw off who the cast is, but I definitely feel for Marianne, and I know there are a lot of critics who just say, oh, talk to people, but it's not always that easy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love Marianne so much. I've said that in every podcast. Like, I truly believe that she is really, I can't think of someone since like Christian in Modern Survivor, and Angelina was, you know, a big character in a different way in that season. And then maybe before that, like a David Wright, like what characters really to me stand out in Modern Survivor as like truly iconic, like clear returnees, which not just because she does the car analogy, but like Marianne's definitely coming back. Like the kind of characters for me that like elevate a whole season, even when I love other characters, but it's like a character that good that I truly feel that makes the whole season better for me. And I think when we talk about it and it's what you can speak to about kind of being on the outs, like that othering is what we see a lot of in this episode, which we can definitely talk about, but it compounds itself. You can say like, go and talk to them, but it's not even like a social situation where, you know, no one has to be on the outs. Like that's the way that social situations tend to go, especially like in high school, for example, like there are cliques and not everyone can be in. And Survivor's often compared to high school because it's a social situation where even if in a natural setting, yes, people end up being on the outs and like that's just the way humans are. Like not everyone's always included. But like Survivor's particularly compared to high school often because it's a social situation which like necessitates outsiders because you need people to vote out. You need like these others so that you can have a majority group and have power and control. And I think that it gets then compounded. You can't just say like go talk to people and be social because there always needs to be someone on the bottom. Like there always needs to be a hierarchy. Like Marianne was that in Taku, even though she was connecting with people in ways and kind of irritating them in other ways, they needed someone who would be the next to go. Like they needed that plan.
Yeah.
And now it gets compounded and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So then it becomes harder and harder to like reach across the aisle because the gap becomes widened because you are the person on the bottom. And because that like behooves the majority to have someone who's on the outs who's not there. So it's like, you know, the hardest situation for these outsiders.
I agree with you 100%. I will say the following, not to jump on the car metaphors, but sometimes when a person is on the out, they can be, you know, like a deer in the headlights, be like, oh, I don't know what's going on. I don't know. And then essentially get voted out. Where I think Marianne is like, well, I realize I'm the out. I need to do something just to get myself back in the game. So I think that even just that self-awareness or that perception to realize this is the 1-3 of the situation. I need to make an adjustment. And the fact that she's able to realize that and know, okay, I need to go and make different, you know, social connections, or I need to now start becoming smart about how I play my idol. The fact that she's realized that, I think, is puts her in a much better position than other people who have been, you know, segregated or you know, on the outs or for whatever reason, essentially without a way back in the game because they feel powerless. I think she at least accepts it and she's like, well, I will definitely put up a fight to stay in the game as long as I can. Let's go.
Yeah. And I really like parts of the way that she's playing from the bottom and doing that, like everything she can and like individual moves without power, which we'll talk about even in this episode. Yeah. And we'll definitely talk about Chanel and Romeo in some of the double standards that are difficult for people on the outs and some of the othering that happens because it's a necessary part of the majority's plans and how difficult that can be for people. But I wanted to ask about Drea while we're still on that with you, because there are parts of Drea's game that you can find some similarities in for your game. I mean, you held four advantages at a time. She has four advantages. And this is why
I'll just clarify. I had four
not at the same time, but four in the game. Yeah.
Same time. Four in the game. Yeah.
You had two idols, you had an extra vote, and you had the reward steal. So she's got four now at the same time, which is crazy. And Drea's game fascinates me, as I've said, in thinking about it as a personification of the modern game, but also because I feel that that bold style of game is often more of a male game, definitely something that's accepted more in men, like a Tony style game in ways like Tony had, you know, some of his own social games, like also probably social missteps with control, but I think maybe more obvious strategic dominance where he's like running things. Drea is definitely part of the group, but I don't know if we see anyone running things to the degree that Tony was through Paths of Winners at War and like through all of Kaguyan. But you know, we see that like Ben and Mike have done this. I already described like Paths of Xander, but all of those people, Ben and Mike and Xander, it's not just that they were men doing it. It's not just that we accept men more playing in that really bold way, but it's also that they, like you, were an underdog who was kind of forced into that position where they're on the bottom and now they have to like fight their way out. Drea chose this approach from day one. It's just who she is. So she's in that like win out position from the first day, doing it with more social capital, definitely doing it with more, you know, strategic room because she's been in the majority, but she's still playing to that like hardness. And she doesn't even get to have to, you know, be forced into it like halfway through the merge. Like she's doing it from the beginning. So I wanted to ask you about that. Like, obviously there's success in the game she's playing, but it's also like such a unique way to play, so difficult, does not come with some of those other demographic parts and game style parts that we often see with the underdog. We've seen it as well with like Wentworth, for example, but like it's just so interesting to me. So like, where do you see parts of that similarity and differences to your own game?
Yeah, it's a great question. One or two people have mentioned this on Twitter as well. I think, I mean, obviously there's a lot to break down, but I think the biggest difference is that, like you said, like when I played, it was essentially a misstep on my part, and that put me out, you know, ranked me down the totem pole and then got into a tribe that kept losing. So I was in the game on the back foot early on, and then coming in, not coming into merge as an outsider, but essentially having to be the one on the outside, and you know, people were coming for me. So it's a much different game than the position of Drea's in, which is in a, you know, didn't lose that much, you know, pre-tribal, pre-merge, and then being in control. So I think if you're in control, you don't necessarily have to use your advantages. You can be a bit more cagey. You can steal a bit more because you don't necessarily have to now scramble or make plays. So that obviously puts in the fortunate position which is in, where, I mean, people know they know about the idol because she had to set the activation phrase, but nothing else that they know.
They know about the extra vote because she told everyone about the extra vote.
Which part of that
felt like a misstep, and parts of it I really liked her connecting with it. They don't know about the amulet, but they could find it out at any time. Especially if she starts an amulet war and then someone else thinks that they're like, if she like takes out Lindsay, for example, and like hires like, okay, she's coming for me. Like, let me kind of expose this. And Tori knows about the red paint. So there are clues in that, but the only one that's like truly a secret that no one else knows about is knowledge is power.
So,
some of that's her fault and some of that is her choice and some of that is not to do with her at all. Like, that's the game.
And one thing I want to send the extra vote, and we've also spoken about this before, it always keeps popping up, but this is my perception, I think the stars really have to align for you to make the extra vote like work out in your favor to like really change the tribal council. I think we've had it like happen once. I think last season,
debated. Did Xander use the pressure of it at the final eight? Ricard did use it to split, but then like it was against contingencies, it didn't even happen. But yes, it made it like possible. So had the most influence last season.
Yes.
But even then. I mean, the Nicaea vote, I feel like that counts. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very rarely that it swings a tribal. But if people find out you have an extra vote, but you didn't tell them, then immediately the perception is, ooh, this guy is very sketchy. You can get rid of him. He's got extra stuff he's not telling us about. But if you use your extra vote and you just tell one or two people, like, hey, I got this extra vote, you tell me when we need it, then we can make a plan with it. They're like, okay, it's cool, because it's not super threatening. You know, they can still vote you out. They don't have that image of this guy's now immune, or what are we going to do? And I keep using this example. I told people about it, and it became public knowledge. And when the merge happened in our season, every single pocket of people came to me like, okay, we need seven. So we're going to have six, and you come with us. You bring your advantage with your extra vote. Then we're seven. So it put me in a position where people were approaching me to be included in whatever the plan was, with essentially me not being the target, right? So I think that the extra vote, in my opinion, the best use of it is always as some kind of a social bargain, not a bargaining tool, but just a bit of, you know, rapport building, confirmation with your allies. I think that's the best use of it. And Jaya has done exactly that, which is great. So yeah, and then, I think, like I said, we'll still see what happens in this five-person tribal. There's essentially her and Mary Ann that have an extra vote, and potentially either Lindsay, Jay, or I, depending on how they play the advantages. And then, yeah, obviously, I've told you what I think about the knowledge is power. I think if you are with your back against the wall, I think it's an extremely powerful tool to stay in the game. But I think it can be a bit of a nuclear option where as soon as you press it, people will be like, okay, well, you know, sure, you're in the game, but... the fallout is so bad that you contaminate, you poison the well, and there's no chance of you getting votes at the end. So, I mean, is she stacked for every, or is she equipped for every single scenario? Absolutely. She can play it in such a way that you get to the end and you're like, dump your bag and say, this is everything I had. Didn't have to use any of this. What a great game I played. Or it can be, you know, one or two great moves, and you can say, well, everybody expected, you know, Jonathan to win, but idled out Jonathan. So I took out the biggest threat. Give me the money. Very similar to what Adam did. And he said, well, I got rid of the guy everybody thought was going to win the season. By default, I'm now the guy with the biggest set of chips. So give me your vote. So yeah, I can see you're using it a lot of ways. I'm impressed that she hasn't played any, but maybe that's because of the item base of the game, because advantages can burn a hole in your pocket for sure. It can definitely start weighing you down. And we've even had people like Mike from our season, as like Open said, like he didn't look for idols because he knew that if he has one, the pressure of what to do with it will just be too much. He doesn't want to have that anxiety in this game. He'll just play a game without it. So, I mean, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, thinking about it, when we talk about the modern game being less social because it's shorter, so Drea's like cutting allies like Romeo. Day one allies like Romeo, whose whole like thing was about how he wants to like build Drea up, and she's like, I don't know you, which is funny to me, and how, you know, it's very advantage heavy. I don't think that those two things are mutually exclusive. Like thinking about it, almost all advantages are like in their nature, at least individual, if not quite antisocial. Not the extra vote, which is like the most collaborative advantage, which is like I'm adding a number to what is already surely like our team at the very least. And maybe that's why we don't see it very effective, because like you're already winning the game in numbers. So that's why we see the ways that it was effective last season were like protecting those numbers with Xander, or like protecting against contingencies. You could use it to like to split a vote, but you're already like winning in the numbers game. Every other advantage at its core is individual. I mean, you think about like the big advantage moves. Kelly Wentworth, like, you know, the biggest move, she like negates all these votes. She got 9 votes. She's losing the numbers game. It's an individual thing. It's like an antisocial thing. I guess, again, if you're considering the socialness of the tribe being the majority, like that's the big social group, and she's against that. And then it compounds with Modern Survivor, where literally the amulet is a bounty, which we'll talk about because I know that you've wanted a bounty thing and you've mentioned it before. That's like a full-on bounty.
I love the bounty concept. It is great.
Yeah,
it is,
it's amazing. For sure. And so, but they have to like, they know that there's like the connection there, but it's actually more of like a detriment to what should be their connection. Knowledge is power. She's stealing an idol, an antisocial thing. And that's why it's interesting for Drea. When we talk about, like, it's usually a male game, we usually see these male games as, like, they can be more individual. Like, again, very, very broadly, but, like, what can be seen as a more, like, feminine game is, like, the social intricacies. Something like how Lindsay is playing, always doing social first. Even when she reads the amulet, she's like, I don't know that I want to, like, be lying to my tribe first up, which I really like. Even when she's sitting out of the rice negotiation, she's already, like, she does it first. She's like, I want to... you know, help out the rest of the tribe. She's like very, very social in that way. That's like a very, like classically, again, very, very broad, but like classically feminine game. We see often like men come out and play this more aggressive game, and it's often the tricks in the bag. And then when we say it's the underdog game, of course it is, because people don't have allies. So if they were allowed to play the individual game, like you didn't have, you know, people who were there for you on the tribe, but you had your, you know, your idol, and that was a nice friend for you to have. Yeah. So I think that like, what's interesting about Drea's game is it has not necessitated this at the point where we currently are, at least, because she has been in the majority. Like, no wonder she hasn't used them. Like, she's voting correctly, but she's going to need to trigger some sort of more individual game to go against people, you know, with the bounty, to protect against those things, to idle people out, to like use these advantages successfully. And I think it's a game she's willing to play because we do see her cut allies. We do see her much less interested in these like tight social connections. But then it comes with the fact that she's been socially in the numbers and strategically powerful. So yeah, that's really, really interesting for me as well, because I think it makes a lot of sense of why her gameplay works with the modern game and why when she's tending towards a lack of socialness, I actually think that that's okay. Even if that's not something that I really enjoy, like the social connection should be what's important. Like the ability to just cut Romeo, I'm like, you're right, you have known him for 2 weeks. Like there is 10 days left. Like, I don't know that you need like a friend for life right now. Like when Omen and Mike are connecting so well, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful TV moment, but like you don't need to love the guy to work with him for a week and a half. So it's just like such an interesting thing for me. And I know I've said that like 100 times in this podcast, but that dichotomy to me is really, really fascinating. And I think so much of it goes into the shortness of the game at the moment, and also the advantages and how that's gotten like more and more antisocial, and even starts kind of in that position. And the fact that Drea holds so many of them, like she really does begin to embody that thinking.
Yes. There's just one thing. We've spoken a lot about Shannon and I about the advantages. There's just one thing I'll say, which I might say I disagree with you. You're saying every, with the exception of the extra vote, every idol or every advantage is self-improvement. Self-interest, yeah. What I will say...
I think you can protect a majority, but...
Yeah, but...
Like,
yeah,
at its core, yeah.
I just want to make the following point. If you, like, let's say you put yourself in you use the Kelly Wentworth scenario. Let's use that. Everybody's ganging up on her. She plays an idol. She sends home whoever they want to do. Whoever she wants to send home. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody's opinion of that afterwards be like, okay, we came for her. She beat us fair and square. It is what it is. Good on you. Well done. Nobody's going to be angry at you because you defended yourself, but you didn't do any malicious damage to anybody else except for voting out the ally. Whereas if you do a knowledge spell, you steal somebody's advantage.
Yeah.
Now it's not just – now it's suddenly leaving a sour taste in the mouth like, hey, wait, this was mine. Now it's yours, and then you might become the black sheep. So I think there's a slight difference in an idol where you just like – it's a defensive item. Shield up and say, I'm shielding myself. Sorry, all the arrows get deflected. This is, I'm not taking weapon, I'm stabbing you with it to get an advantage, because then it feels like an attack and not a defensive move, if that makes sense.
No, I agree. I think that it's become much more extremely against others because knowledge of power, you're stealing something or steal a vote, you steal it from someone. Yes. The amulet has like a specific bounty. I just think that the idol, as a tool, when you think about it at its core, starts in a fairly self-interested place. It's definitely a more neutral item, and it can be used for like more versatile reasons. It doesn't have to be like that. But I think like at its core, when we think about like power idol plays, they are like self-interested moves or like not with the group, because that's the point. If you're getting all the votes to use an idol, you're not, you know, with the group, it's not as much being with the numbers and like the socialness of it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a much more neutral item. But I think like starting at that base and then it's been built up through it. And I think, yeah, now Drea has the tools in the bag and some of the play styles to kind of correspond with it. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about the bounty part of the amulet before I want to talk about like Omer, for example, and his comparisons in this way. Because you said, I think, was it the last podcast we did or within the most recent podcast that we did, you wanted a specific bounty. Must have been in Survivor South Africa that we were talking about it. You wanted a specific bounty twist. And the amulet is as close as we have to that. Like, it's a fake connective tool that is almost completely a pure bounty. Like, it could have pretty much, they could have, like, left out all of the stuff about, like, you can use it together and just been like, when there's one of you left, it's an idol. And that is, I think, 90% of what the advantage is. So, like, what do you think about, like, the bounty aspect of that?
I love bounty idols or bounty tools in any kind of game, whether it's a board game or a video game or a game like Survivor. And not to say too much, but we might in future see a bounty idol in a Survivor South Africa, which was something I might have passed on to the people who, you know, make the show. So I have two fantastic bounty ideas in my head. I'm not going to say them because people might listen to this and prepare for them. But I love the concept. And I think a bounty in the game is fascinating because people always complain about, oh, there's a begonging or they're just taking down, you know, you know, the minority, or, you know, it's this tribe, you know, just telling off that tribe. But as soon as there is a bounty component in the game, as soon as you know, well, if I vote out this person, if I can switch the target to somebody within my alliance and get that bounty, there's a massive boon in it for me. So then you see like a lot of, because you always, you sometimes see people, try and use an example. Let's take season 8, Nicole. I don't want to get too many spoilers. I mean, people watch this, you know, but
yeah, it's fine.
She played for the most part a very passive game, and just at the right time at the end being boom, boom. And essentially, you know, she ended up with the crown on her head. Whereas I think, you can essentially win survival by playing a passive game, but I think the bounty puts an impetus on anybody to actually make a move. And it might be, I mean, you have people who enjoy making moves, but if you are a person who just plays a passive game, and now suddenly there's a bounty in it, now you become, become conflicted. There's a bit of internal conflict. There's external conflict. So I think it's a win-win-win for everybody. It's exciting for the audience because they're like, okay, how long can this guy keep you know, this extra whatever he has before somebody finds out and they want to swap around? Or if, let's say, you have a bounty and you vote somebody out, now it's like, okay, well, there was a bounty. Who now has the bounty? You know, it's almost like a winner's tour. You vote somebody out, like, okay, who did they give their coin to? Now you're starting to, you know, tomorrow morning wake up and everybody's like, this Mexican standoff, where everybody's looking at each other like, okay, now who has it? You know, who's got the blues now, you know? I enjoy it. I think it's fascinating. And I think what's cool here is it's not necessarily a legacy advantage that gets passed down, but it's rather something that like I call it the interest advantage, which will become stronger. So you don't want to use yours because then it dilutes that value. But if you can get somebody else out, then suddenly yours, you know, you get bigger ammunition in the game. So yeah, it's fascinating to me. It's multi-layered. It adds strategic component to it. It adds a social component because you need to work with somebody you don't necessarily want to work with. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I also think what's underrated about it is the three-way bounty of it. Because, like, if it's just two people, yes, like, well, you vote that person out and the secret dies with you and now you just
exactly
have the thing. Versus
yeah, that's a good
the
point.
First part is, like, the warning shot that you're giving to the other person of the bounty. So, like, say that they are separated next week, which they are going to be, and Hive's on one tribe and Drea and Lindsay on the other. Drea sees her chance, she's with some outsiders, she uses her extra vote, she takes out Lindsay. Now Hive's going to be like, well, that's concerning. And then he can fight back and maybe tell people about, like, the shared secret that they have. Yeah. Or even more than that, like, Drea might need Hai to take out Lindsay if they're going to, like, go for Taku and she wants to make it, like, a Lindsay thing to get the amulet. Hai's aware of that. Is he going to want to do that? Or she might want to go against Vati or take out, like, the power duo of Hai and Mike. So then she work with Lindsay, but then Lindsay's like, wait, no, why are we going for Hai and not for Mike? Oh, you want the, the amulet. So working together becomes difficult. The warning shot becomes difficult. So I think that is actually a really fun part of the bounty, because it's very, very tricky for Drea to A, get it done. I mean, she has the defense mechanism, so that's why I think she should still go for it. But, like, yeah, that we even talked about it last week. Like, well, maybe they don't, like, Hai wouldn't want to take out Lindsay because, like, you trigger an amulet war where you've, like, basically told Drea to come for you now because you're, like, a straight shot away. And maybe she thinks that's something you're trying to do if you've, like, taken that shot. So I do think it's a really interesting mechanism, and we'll see how it plays out. But I wanted to kind of talk about Omer's game because I thought he was a really big part of this episode as well.
Yeah.
More kind of continuing on of what we know about him. But I loved how he's using his lack of vote to you know, kind of shield or hide how he was voting last time to continue those connections. It's so old school, it's so classic, it's so socially strategic, and it's all about, like, balancing that threat level and that awareness. Like, it's an opposite game to what Drea is doing. They've both laid out this framework that they're doing, I think, at this point to, like, optimal success. But he's very much aware of, like, well, he doesn't have any advantages, but he's, like, you know, helping Marianne keep hers. Like, maybe she'll use it for him. He's aware of who has what. He has those connections. He has that information. So what do you think about that game, as we've just talked about, what Drea's doing? Such a stark comparison, like, clear, stark opposites and things like sitting out in the way that he does it versus the way that she does it. It's the same move, just done in totally different ways. And I feel like it's so fascinating for me to see the stark comparison of two successful games, but they're polar opposites.
Absolutely. And one thing I'm glad this episode happened that I can chat to you about this, Shannon, because I was in a very similar position on our season, where at the beginning of the merge, I had the extra vote. And like I mentioned earlier, a lot of people were coming to me, you know, to to start using it. And I could essentially vote with the one group and tell the other group, you know, vote. I voted with the majority against the minority, but then I'm like, oh, I don't know what's going on. So I had like essentially two or three rounds until eventually the camouflage was being like, oh, you know, it's like an episode of Scooby-Doo, like putting up a mask. Oh, this is who you're really voting for. You know, it took a while and that's always fun. If you can play numerous sides for a long period of time and Omar's doing it right now. I mean, eventually somebody is going to, you know, compare notes and realize, okay, Omar was voting against, and I think it might be the next episode. But one thing I will say, which fascinates me about Omar's game, and I want to take you all the way back to the pre-merge in the episode that Swati got voted out. They did exactly the same thing. Okay. Omar's going to everybody, having conversations with everybody. He's got a finger in every pie that's on the table, but nobody's suspicious about it. Swati did the same thing, but the small difference is she went to five people and told five people, I am your number one. I am your number one. And I'm your number one. I'm your number one. It's almost like a pinky swear. It's like, okay, you and me to the end, ride or die, baby, let's go. And if people find out you have more than one number one, then your credibility becomes zero. Okay. But what Omar's doing is he's going to different pockets of people and he's giving them information, which isn't information. He's telling Marianne, I'm coming to you now. They want to flush your idol. I'll keep a note on it and I'll tell you when it's going down, but I got your back. I mean, it's such a non-info move because obviously at some point in time, they want to get rid of Marianne's idol. So telling her that you're giving nothing away, but at the same time, you are gaining her trust because she's like, okay, you know, almost he's got my back. The same way he's like, you know, like, okay, what we want to do, Romeo, we're going to split it. It's either going to be Tori or Chanel. I mean, they know that, but him telling Romeo, we're going to split in one of these two people, is like, okay, cool, thanks, keep me posted. So he's not giving away any information by just telling them what they know, but they see it as, this guy's coming to me, he's really got my back, I will make sure that I got his back, and it is a brilliant way of using, because he mentioned information is currency, and he's doing this perfectly, where he's not paying himself in the corner, but at the same time, he's building his connections and making people feel that they're number one. And people who do that, he called it in our season, phenomenal players.
I mean, you mentioned Marianne, and for me, it's more than just the information. Like, he was there for her in a way that I don't even think I realized last week. Like, Taku weren't. Like, Lindsay has to come and apologize to Marianne. She obviously threw Marianne out last week, and, you know, Omar had the benefit of being immune, so he wasn't, like, scrambling the way that the rest of Taku were. But it wasn't really a Taku thing. Like, it feels like Omar really reached the hand out and was the one bringing Marianne into the vote when she's not even in the majority. And more than just the information, like, he's being there for her. Like, you know, think about, like, how on the outs you felt, and just to have someone who is there for you and makes you feel included or cared for or protected in some way. Like, the emotional impact that can have, I think, is bigger than even, like, how much information is he really giving. Like, she knows that he's saying he has her back. You know, whether he ends up doing it, that'll be its own thing. But he's reaching out that hand. And I think that is so powerful. I think also you talk about, like, someone like Swathi who's doing this kind of game poorly versus Omar who's doing it well, because there are similarities of, like, you know, he's talking to everyone. It does kind of feel like Omar's game could be unraveled in just a few conversations. It would just take people who aren't connected at this time to be like, wait, is Omar telling you things? I mean, we've even happened, like, Rox told Tori something, like, she comes back.
Yeah.
Whereas for Omar, it's not happening. I think a lot of that is on the read of knowing kind of, like, what he can tell to what people and what they're going to bring back to each other. And also just, like, using the fact that they're so disparate from each other and that there's this, like, you know, minority-majority thing that feels quite stark to us, where people are, like, like, they're having these, like, contentious relationships, like arguments, you know, like Mike and Chanel and even Dre and Romeo are breaking apart, and he's in the middle of that connecting it. So, like, they're too far apart from each other to even have the conversations to, like, check notes that he's the one running around talking to everyone. And I think he's using that by not having contentious relationships with anyone. So it's, again, just, like, pure socialness that other people aren't using as much, having social missteps or having social gaps with players, even if they are in the minority, where he gets that information because he's just, like, with everyone and so connected. And I think, again, it's really fascinating to me because it's based on the necessity for balance, like, balance of getting those wins, but still pulling back on threat level. Like, we see that he pushed hard last week because he needed to, but this week he's like, oh, I don't care who goes. And I love that. I think pulling back is necessary. That push and pull has been the beauty of what Survivor at its core was. And I think Omer is an old school player in that way. It was always about, like, how far do you push? How much are you willing to win challenges, find things, play things, like make yourself a threat, or are you inherently a threat? So it's, again, balanced against, like, who you are as a person and how you're perceived versus, though, like, how much are you pulling back so that you aren't as visible, so that you don't get taken out in that way. And that, like, core balance and, like, kind of fragility of the game was what made it so fascinating and continues to. And that's what I've been thinking about Modern Survivor, is, like, how much has it become? If Drea has success in it, does that show that Omer's way of thinking is outdated in, like, super, super successful subterfuge social strategy games versus super, super successful play hard games, but you have to play it at its best? But does that show, if Drea has success in that way, does it show that Survivor has lost that balance, which it definitely has to a degree, but, like, how much has it lost it? Where is Survivor like an Olympic sport now, where if you find the most things, win the most challenges, play the hardest, get the most wins, you will win the game? That is not what Survivor used to be. You couldn't just, like, win and win the game, because you'd get taken out. Like, too much success would cut you, and that's why it was a balance. So that's what I'm thinking about in terms of Modern Survivor, and I think how it plays out might show that in these two different play styles. Like, if Drea does use all these advantages and then, like, beats Omer at Fire, that to me would be, like, kind of like an interesting embodiment of that. And we'll see how the rest of the season goes. But I do think, you know, Jason says I'm going a little bit hard in it, which I definitely agree that I am, and we haven't seen it play out. But I just think seeing these different play styles, to me, is just an interesting thought experiment about where Survivor is and what it necessitates, even if it's against play styles that we as super fans maybe enjoy, some of that social strategy stuff. I love it. I love watching it. I think Omer's doing it amazingly well. And I just wonder how relevant it is in the 40s. So I'm just, yeah, keeping an eye on that, if that makes sense.
No, I hear you. And I've said this, I think, on every single podcast. If you're not going to say it, go in detail, but Survivor has something for everybody. Some people enjoy the strategy. Some people enjoy the advantages. Some people just watch Jonathan run around without his shirt. And that's what's the beauty of this game, is that it's something for everybody to, as a viewer.
Yeah, that's what Jeff likes, I think. Like, that's what Jeff gets out of the show.
Exactly.
And Jonathan without his shirt on.
And I'll just say the following, now that I've rolled and mingled with a bit of the London Underground Survivor community.
The Lundground. How did you not go with Lundground?
The Lundground. Then it sounds like a German word, but the Lundergrund. The Lundergrund. But I mean, like, so it's interesting watching it with them, because, like you said, you know, some super fans value completely different things to what, like, some of my common friends, not common friends, but Survivor commoners who just watch the episodes and get all their life, like, they like completely different things in a Survivor pledge, you know. And it's fascinating. And that's, there's no right and wrong. You know, the one group isn't right, the other group wrong. I think both, some people can enjoy different facets of the game, and that's why it is such a great show. One thing I just want to mention about Omer, you know, bring it back to what you were saying about him. You also need to remember that people who are at the bottom, they don't have anybody, right? So they don't have that, like, buddy cop who's got their back, or they don't have somebody who's in the trenches next to them. They are completely, essentially fighting the game alone. So it's rare in a game for, like, Survivor, for somebody to have your back. So if you are in a position where you have nothing, or you've got nobody, and you are concerned about what's happening, and somebody like Omer comes around and is like, hey, listen, don't worry, I'll tell you when it's you, I got your back. You, even though he might have a conversation with eight people, if you just put yourself in Mary Ann's shoes, like, she went day one, she made him the mat, which he used just to pray on, still within the episode, we saw that scene with Mike. So she's like, well, I've got a connection with Omer, and he's coming to me, telling to me, even though I'm left out of a vote, he's telling me that he will let me know when my idol is played. You feel at that point like, wow, a ray of sunshine. There's hope. You know, it's not all despair. So you latch onto that in that moment because you've got nothing else to latch onto, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to say, oh, well, I'm thinking to everybody, oh, she should just talk to other people or whatever. But it's not easy doing it when you're in the game to have that kind of, you know, not everybody has, you know, 20 allies or in a majority alliance. So when you are in that point, somebody just giving you a reaffirming message or telling you, listen, I'll let you know, that is massive. And that's why people who can do that successfully ultimately make it deep in the game. And those people who do that, whenever you have to eventually vote out, if you are Omer, eventually vote out Mary Ann, you can just say at the end, like, Miriam, there was five people left. I mean, it was either you or me, right? You were voting, writing my name down. I voted your name. It is what it is. But don't forget about all these other moments we shared where I had your back. And they're like, yeah, okay, he's right. Boom. Write down his name for a minute. So it's a great strategy. A social game as well.
I mean, I am a little concerned from a jury perspective because I feel like people might feel burned by Omar because he is acting like he's connected to everyone and he can't be connected to everyone because some people have to go home. That's what can become tricky when you play this emotional game, because I feel like Omar's game is all about like how you make people feel, the influence that he has is in that. Like if you look at it, like he votes on the secondary in this vote, like he doesn't need to be like voting on the primary. He didn't even need to vote last time. He's not immune this time. Like, there's no protection. There's no mechanisms at all. There's not even a vote sometimes. It's literally just on relationships. But that can become tricky when the jury turn around and maybe they're angry about it. Although I do think modern US juries mostly respect and like and are fine with that. I want to compare Omar then to move on to like Mike and Hai, who we can kind of talk about the vote with. They seem to be really driving it. You know, they were really very much in the front seat of the car of the vote. Because Omar, as we see, does step back and he's like, I don't care. Mike and Hai care a lot in different ways. Mike is like set on it being Chanel. It seems like quite emotional and quite personal. It definitely is, because it's literally based on what we're talking about, like the kind of hypocritical vote that was given both ways.
This is not strategic. It's strictly personal. That is what...
100%. And he basically said that. And Hai, you know, his stuff is strategic against Romeo, which we'll talk about. But even then, like, I felt that they were both doing a lot and maybe investing a lot of social capital and getting what was like kind of an unimportant vote over the line. Like, Romeo and Chanel both seem like there'll be issues for them. Like, you can definitely have an opinion about it either way, which we will talk about. Like, they're both doing a lot to, like, which person on the bottom are we going to vote out of the game? So I guess first part, what do you think was the right move of Chanel versus Romeo? And then we can talk about, like, the ways that they got it done.
Are we, from whose perspective are we talking? Are we speaking,
I guess from Mike and Hai as a duo.
Mike. Okay.
And in general, possibly.
I think from Mike's perspective, I think it was the right move because As much as we like to think of Survivor as a chess game, if it was a chess game, we wouldn't have Dante shouting at people. We wouldn't have people crying. We wouldn't have people saying, oh, I want to give up this to make the loved one visit. You know, because it's not a chess game. It's not an ultimate min-max function. It is a game of human emotion. So if you, for whatever reason, start getting fixated with a personal vendetta, in my opinion, if you have a personal vendetta and you can get your vendetta out of a game, then suddenly it's like, okay, the smoke has lifted. I've now got it's a clear sunny day. Now I can think again. But if you have a vendetta and you are like, it's either you or me for whatever reason, then you can get fixated on that. And if it doesn't go your way, you're like, I want to do it next. We've seen it so many times where people have these fixations. And if they don't get them out, if people don't work around with them this round, that, you know, the next round and the following one day, they don't make the optimal moves for their game because they are fixated on something. So I think from Mike's perspective, I think getting rid of Chanel for him was the best move. What I will say, and I really enjoy Mike. I think he's one of the people who's probably, from my perspective, grown the most, you know, as viewers enjoying him. You know, you start out, you see, okay, he's just this big older guy, but then he's building these really cool connections. He's, you know, like I said, he's got the great scene with Omar. He's really... like, it's like this dad figure to a lot of people. But I get slightly pissed off as the person who's played this game, where there's a scenario where you vote for me, I vote for you, but now you're the bad guy because you wrote my name down. I'm like, well, you did the same thing, you know? So at final tribals, the people are like, oh, I'm so angry because you're coming for me. And then you turn around, but you came for me as well. So who of us are wrong? So in that regard, I don't see it as Chanel was wrong and Mike was right. I think they both were clashing for whatever reason. They both wanted to get the other one out. They've both written down each other's name. So inevitable, it was a battle of will and a battle of who could summon the more allies. Mike won the battle. So in that case, I feel, say, good for him. But I don't feel Chanel was a bad person because she wanted to vote out somebody in the game. I mean, like Tony said, Adam, that's the rules. We go up there, we ride name, we come back, Jeff reads it, the person goes home. That's how it works. I mean, it's not our fault. We didn't design the game. We just play it. So, but yeah, I think Mike made the right move with getting rid of Chanel.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue the right move would be not to fixate to begin with.
Yes, sure.
But once you're fixating, like, he gets her out. We'll talk about, like, how much he and Hai invest into those plans. I do think, obviously, you've talked about it. It's really hard not to see how Mike's not, like, completely hypocritical here. Like, they broke apart at the same time due to the unfortunate circumstance that Janelle lost her vote, which was her fault, but it was malicious. It was, like, this terrible mistake that destroyed almost everyone in its wake at a point. Daniel, Janelle never recovered from that. Jenny goes home with that. Just, like, really, just it's hard to think of a move, like, one single move, individual move that someone does that could have, like, that's had, like, as catastrophic repercussions. Yes. The fact that, like, Daniel and Chanel then go at, like, the next available tribal councils when they're vulnerable, wow, there's just no recovery from just, like, the Shipu Island decision.
I think a lot of people are saying, oh, it's such a bad move, and it's, you know, she should have, you know, saved the vote, which I also think is the right move. But I will just say this. This reminds me very much of – it reminds me of two votes. It reminds me of the vote when season 8, Survivor SA, where Anita and Amy went home, where everybody was like, oh, such a stupid twist or whatever. They could have gone home. But the mistake wasn't – the mistake in the game didn't happen on that on the Thai Destinies. The mistake happened the week earlier when Anita misplayed his idol. If he had his idol or I've played it correctly, you know, with winning government numbers, or saved it, and then you could have helped himself and Amy. And a similar game in our season when they blindsided Sipay, and I was just okay being like, okay, well, they blindsided my close ally, but I'll just keep going down this road. And then 3 weeks down the line, you're in such a spot because of not making that change. So I think there's very little she could have done this episode, and I think it's just purely a matter of there was a time when that she could have taken control of her own game. Unfortunately, she didn't do it. And this is just a spillover effect. So it becomes very bad if you lose a lot of momentum early in the game and other people gain attraction to make that turnaround. Mm. And it just had, like you say, catastrophic, lasting consequences for her and her immediate allies, for sure.
Yeah, like it all happened at Chipwil Island. Like the amount that they lost at Chipwil Island and then through that afternoon and not getting it back. Like I talked about it on that week with Tarot of them, like, being at the top of the hill with all of the power and then rolling down the hill. I didn't know that they would, like, continue to roll to this point where, like, now Chanel's also out of the game and so is Daniel. And, like, that's the end of that chapter. And it just, like, it never got better. But that's why you know, you have to see the hypocrisy for Mike, who they split apart at that point due to the circumstance. They don't have the power. They have to go to Hai and Lydia. He, like, wins that interaction. And then the first time they vote, they both split for very similar reasons on each other. And she is the bad guy for that. And she said in exits as, like, this gender double standard, which I think it's, you know, it's definitely true for women. It's definitely true for women of color. And it's probably also true for Chanel at certain parts of this game. But I want to talk about, like, the two double standards that she gives, because I feel like there's different parts of that. Like, firstly, she says the double standard that she's seen is, like, screwing over Omen, he didn't screw over her. I actually disagree that that's a double standard. I think the precedent we've seen is that if you're going to tribal council, you protect. Like, it's happened every time. It happened last season. That, like, that's not a gender thing, I think, at all. I don't even think that that's a double standard. I think that there's, like, a pre-explicit social contract that many other people, Evie did it, Chan did it, like, other players have read about the necessity of the vote. Like, that's the difference. Like, that's the leverage. Is like, I'm going to tribal council tonight. I need my vote, so I'm willing to offer it to you. So that's why it feels much more like she screwed over Omar, because Omar did what we expect someone in the position of someone who's not going to tribal to do. The same thing Sean did, the same thing Liana did. Chanel deviated from the clear path of what you do with Chibo. So I don't see that at all as a double standard. Like, she's the one who went away, she's straight from the path,
Even in Ghost Island, when, was it Kelly? No, not Kelly.
Kellen.
She also said, I'm not playing because I'm not risking my vote because I need it tonight, which was at that point in time her game, the right move to do. So, sometimes you have to, you know, sometimes you have to close your eyes and jump in with both feet and say, I'm risking it. But sometimes you have to, you know, evaluate the situation. And that's part of understanding where you fit in. Do you have the numbers? Will it make a difference if you can vote yes or no? Because that is the one thing. You can always do. You can always vote someone out. You might not necessarily win them in a challenge, but you can just write down their name. And I agree with you. And I don't. I mean, it's a slippery slope. I don't want to go down too much, but I don't see that as a double standard thing.
I think it's
people from different races and genders and whatnot have been in the same situation, and other people have made different choices, and it worked out in their game. So
yeah,
it's as simple as that.
Yeah, every other person who ever went to Shippo Island with Tribal Council that night, protected. So yeah, she deviates from that clear plan. In terms of the double standard with Mike, I again don't know that that's gendered, but it's definitely a double standard, as we're saying, definitely hypocritical. But I think the double standard that we're seeing here is the double standard of power versus not power. We also see this with Romeo. It's like, yeah, what's good for the majority is not good for someone who is in the minority. So I think it becoming bad in the game, like she committed the sin that Mike did, I don't see that as gendered either. Again, like there's definitely other ways that, you know, this impacts on women and women of color in untellable ways through the game that I think is clear. But in this example, I feel that like he has the room and the agency by being in power to punish her, even in his own hypocrisy. Like she's on the bottom. She doesn't have the space to penalize him for a vote against her. Like she's just trying to stay alive. Like he has the control now to be like, you've done the wrong thing, even if he's wrong in that like personal move, because he did the same thing. But I think we see comparisons as well to Romeo, and that's how we see them in the same position with the same kind of double standard.
Yeah.
His scheming is villainized because he's other. Like he's not that part of the group. The majority members, like they're allowed to play. But like that's the double standard, and I think we see it all the time where it's like, how dare you do this thing that I did, but it's okay that I did it because it's okay that I do anything because I'm in control. So I think that we saw that so much in this episode.
Listen, Shannon, you do not have to tell me what it's like if people are coming for you and you defend yourself when you, and then suddenly you get painted as a bad guy for trying to stay in the game. I mean,
I feel like maybe you're the poster boy for that.
I am, but
you're actually on the cover of that point.
Yes,
you know, like if we were to put, if we were to make a dictionary definition of demonize something someone does that everyone else
Wikipedia
is doing, probably worse.
Yeah, the Wikipedia that is the picture. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, I, and it's, you know what, it's one of those things where, again, people watch this and they say, oh, this guy is just quitting. He's just rolling over and dying. He's not putting up a fight. And you know, so many people want to be on Survivor, but this guy's just giving up, okay? Then when they do fight, they go, oh, this guy's so paranoid. You know, he's, they're coming for him. He's running around trying to save his life. Guys, you can't have both. Choose one, right? So you can't fault somebody if, I mean, his read on the game is correct. He has been on the out of the vote twice. He realizes that his closest ally isn't making eye contact to him anymore, isn't speaking.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes that, you know, people are, he's excluded from the conversations, and people are telling him, like, listen, you are one of the potential names that's being thrown out. What should he do? I mean, you can't fault the guy for them saying, oh, I want to create chaos, or I want to start running around and figure out what's going on. I mean, that is what you need to do. That is how you play the game. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely feel for Romeo. I don't think he's a bad guy for trying to save his skin. I don't think. And, I mean, different people, you know, some people, you know, like strategize. Some people like to talk to people. Some people like to spend this time to go look for idol, whatever it is. But now painting him as a, as a slippery character, or as a villain, or whatever, I fully understand the emotion that he's feeling, and I also think that it's not right. It is a bit double standard for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think calling him paranoid like implies irrationality that seems unfair. Like it's a rational feeling. He's feel like it's correct. His read is correct. His awareness is right. I actually thought his awareness was really good because he like knew enough not to play a shot in the dark. So he knows he's not the primary because that would be the move then. But he also like knows well enough that he's not in the group. His vote doesn't matter. So he throws like a spite vote to high, which I'm not saying that's a good move, but I'm just saying like he knows the dynamics enough to know that like that's something he can do. I assume in the spite vote because he spelled high like bi. And he wouldn't be doing it to protect against like Chanel shot in the dark because he wouldn't think that like nine people are going to pile on Chanel. So he wouldn't need to do that compared to like the smaller tribes where Chanel thinks maybe she can do that and the votes are going to be piled on her, which even with three people they didn't do, they split against her. So he just knows that he can throw that spite vote. But it's that read and awareness that I think actually makes him dangerous, and actually why I think from a majority perspective, Mike's got his own stuff, but I think for the whole majority, like I would take out Romeo. He probably is much of a muchness, but like he is aware. Like paranoia is a very unfair word to use for that because again, it's not irrational. But there's other parts of that that are like synonymous with what he's doing. Paranoia, not the word, but maybe like there's definitely chaos feels right. Like the hustle, the the fact that, like, the awareness, like, the fact that he knows the inroads he's trying to make. Like, he at least, like, has, like, a relationship with Tori to, like, get this information. Like, Chanel seemed completely on her own or, like, very dependent on Hive, who's not working with her. I think Romeo has more strategic acumen, something he could maybe do that I think makes him a better target. And it's actually ironic because I said that I thought they should have voted out Chanel over Daniel because she was self-interested enough to split, but Daniel's was going along with the group and trying to work with them. This time, Chanel's just trying to work with them. And Romeo throws a spite vote, which to me is like, okay, well, he's got some fight in him that he's like really trying to work against you. And maybe at a point could gain the capital, maybe to actually do it. Maybe next week when they split into different teams, like if he has the numbers, like he seems more aware or at least with more relationships that he could maybe do that. So he's more dangerous. So I think for the group, like that actually shows how much they should have gone with Romeo, but it's not a paranoia thing. It's like the actual active things that he's doing within that, that are based on correct reads. And that's why it's fair.
Yeah. And I just want to say two things about this specific interaction between Romeo and Drea. Firstly, on Romeo's side, if I ever play Survivor again, the biggest thing I will change, isn't the biggest thing I will change, but whenever there's a vote and I thought it was going one way because that's what my alliance or majority was doing and it goes another way, like, the vote gets read, the people are out. I'm like, okay, I'm taking my torch, I'm staying up. I'm like, I'm done with this. New people, new plan, let's go. I'm not rolling with it again because I made that mistake the first time. So as soon as you are out of a loop, you need to seriously reevaluate. And that's why I think a lot of people in our season lost because they were out of the loop, but they just like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep going with this. Instead of saying, well, I'm drawing a line in the sand, doing the loose change alliance and gathering all the people and say, well, let's try and make resistance because we don't, they're going to lose anyway, right? That's the first thing. So as soon as you're in that position, I think you need to, like, you need to do a 180 and get other people on your side. What I will say is with Drea saying, you know, Romeo has become paranoid and you used the word, perhaps irrational. I think this move also reminds me very much of the opening of the pilot for season 8 when the leader was like, he's working with Jason, but he was like, this guy is so paranoid. Like, I would rather have predictability in my enemies than unpredictability in my allies. So, you know, vote him out. So I can fully understand Drea being like, I had worked with Romeo, but he's now become an unpredictable bot, which I don't want to manage. It's not good for my game to manage unpredictable people. So even though you are potentially aligned with me, I'd rather be aligned with a predictable enemy than with an unpredictable ally. So I don't fault her for cutting ties with Romeo.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how Romeo possibly could have picked up and why he would be paranoid when Drea's things are saying things at Tribal Council that are like, vaguely speaking, I had an ally 16 days ago. We worked really well together, but sometimes they end up not being good for your game. She was speaking like so specifically about their relationship and yeah. She was talking like in like blanket terms, which I thought was funny. But I think what's hard as well is like the paranoia thing is chicken or the egg. Like we said last week, like we speculated, okay, maybe he's just not in because they're not vibing with him. Because even he had a comment of being like, when he was vulnerable before the results were switched by the hourglass, he said he'd been like really nervous. Like if he's even speaking to it, like he kind of knows maybe the vibes that he was giving off. And it can just take 1 or 2 days of like intense socializing when everyone's meeting and you're putting people off to just not being with the group. Like Drea can't tie herself to that sinking ship when if no one else wants to work with him, like that's their prerogative at that point. But then it compounds. Yeah. You know, like then like those nerves, okay, now you're not in, but now you know you're not in. Okay, well now it's getting worse and now like you have like the paranoid edit where like maybe you were for a bit, but you were going to come back, but now you're actually on the outs and you're reading it and you're correct. And we definitely saw, you know, in the latest Australian Survivor, there was stuff about like being paranoid when like they were also trying to make Sam paranoid. And then they were complaining that she was paranoid and exactly, she had every reason to be paranoid and she had like so many things to be fearful of. And then people complains about it. But then as well, we said, like, it matters how you make people feel. And I think Romeo can probably wear parts of that considering he spoke to it about how nervous he was in those first couple of days. So I think, like, all of these things can coexist. Tough spot for him, maybe just, like, really not socially connecting in a fast-moving game of those first couple of days of the non-merge when other people were coming together with, like, real connections. We see, like, Roxroy, Jonathan, Mike, like, they're, like, the good, solid guy thing. And they've connected in that way, again, like way beyond where it seems a lot of these initial tribes connected because they were all such a mess. And he just did not vibe with them. And now he's other. he's demonized. And that's a really, really hard spot for him to get out of. But I wanted to talk about, because you mentioned, like, they should draw a line in the sand. I think coming back, it was interesting to me how much Chanel and Romeo were, like, mad at Drea and High, or at High and Drea, respectively. Because I feel like, okay, maybe draw a line in the sand, but I feel like they kind of had no leg to stand on. I mean, they do actually have a leg to stand on to be mad that they were left out of the vote by both of them. But I think you have to come in hand, even though it's so unfair. They're coming in and they're so mad. Like, Drea and High don't even care enough to give them good excuses. Like, they're deflecting. Oh, I thought my fault. You are weren't in camp. But, like, at the end of the day, they're like, let's just, like, get this conversation over, go to bed. One of you's going next. Like, we're the ones that are in power. And maybe they, like, Oma should be reaching more across the aisle and definitely, like, cutting off social avenues is never good. But they still have way more leverage than Chanel and Romeo, who are coming in there angry. Like, I think in a perfect world, even if you wanted to turn against them, even just to blindside them or have them think that you're with them, or to try and connect with them, like, if you can't get a minority group together, which they can't, you want to be in as good as you can. Like, I think in a perfect world, you want to come in and say, like, Lele, I wasn't in on the vote. I don't know what happened. It was a misunderstanding. I hope I showed how much I want to work with you. Like, I voted the way you told me to vote. And, like, hopefully, like, I really appreciate it to be included in the future. Like, yes, that's a pathetic thing to have to do, and you've been left out. And they have every right to be angry, but they also socially shouldn't be angry. And then they can work from there and see what options they have. But as much as you want to draw a line in the sand, I don't think you want that to be obvious. Like, I think you want to be coming in hand. So, yeah, I think that it was a hard one from the beginning of the episode from Chanel and Romeo, like, right off the bat.
Yeah. Like, that conversation that Romeo had with High, it's the exact conversation that I had with Rob the night after CPA vote. I'm like, what happened? Like, no, we didn't have time to tell you.
Yeah.
Like, we had a whole day of sitting around cooking and you couldn't tell me.
Yeah.
But, so it's such a, I'm like, no, but so, I mean, like I said, I've heard that conversation. I've heard that line. It does not bode well for your game.
Mm.
But you're right. I think, and even though, I mean, they don't even have to form a majority. They can just get like a plurality. I mean, if Tori didn't know who she was voting for, if Marianne didn't know who she was voting for, if Chanel didn't know, and Romeo, that's four people out of the remaining 11. I'm like, okay, well, the four of us were all lied to by what's happening. So we can just create this pocket. If we lose, we lose. But let's at least the four of us try. Because Tori, obviously, she knows she's about. Nobody likes her. It's either Chanel or Romeo. Like, if they're coming for either one of us, why don't we unite and go against them? And it's something we've seen so many times. We've seen it on season 7 of Survivor's SA. We've seen it again this time on the latest US Survivor. Australian Survivor, very similar, where there's this big, not big, but there's a bigger group, and the small people can say, well, we're four people, we've got one idol, you want to go, let's go. I mean, if you lose, you lose, but if you don't make the move, you lose anyway. That's always my approach of it. So yeah, I mean, I think they had a window, but I don't know what happened between Chanel and Romeo that they couldn't reconcile or connect the align their games, but yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, a lot of the times when we see these, like, minorities not try to work together against a big group, it's just like the unseen good things that the majority is doing. I think we missed a lot of that in Australian Survivor, where we didn't see, like, the relationships that, like, Josh had with Shay, for example, where she really felt like she was in with the majority. So they're not going to work together because they actually feel closer to members of the majority than they do with each other. And I think that's probably true of this group. Obviously, the majority is not splitting in ways where they could even come over the top with a split. If they got enough information, like, yes, like, maybe Marianne's idol could be shared around, but they're not connecting to each other. Like, Marianne's connected to Omar, Chanel's been connected to High. So that's, like, a good thing that they're doing. And they're also blindsiding people. Like, Chanel doesn't play a shot in the dark.
Yeah, so
a
shot in the dark.
It's also just the subterfuge. But it's interesting what you say. Like, I've heard that line of, oh, we just didn't have time. Are you aware of the concept, he's just not that into you? you know, it was a movie started on Sex and the City, which Miranda came up with in Sex and the City, which is basically like the lines that men will tell women in which they're like, oh, I don't have time to come up after the date because I'm working tomorrow. I've got like work early. And Miranda was basically saying, like, if he's into you, like, he's coming upstairs or he's going to text you back. Or, I just didn't have time. Sorry, my day's been so busy. Like, the point of he's just not that into you, which I think is strategically relevant, is that,
it is.
Like, if they want to, they will. Like, if they wanted to tell you, they'd have found the time. I feel like that's key to these minority members. Like, oh, you just weren't at the right time at camp. Like, if they wanted you to know, you'd know. he's just the alliance just not that into you. I think that is really important. Like, I think that's strategically relevant.
Absolutely. No, for sure. Like I said, it's a story that I've heard. Flashbacks. I'm like, well, dude, you are in some serious hot water if this is the game position you're in. Trust me. Been there. Prognosis, long-term prognosis, not good.
Yeah, dead on arrival. Like, I feel that for Romeo, such an unfortunate fall from grace. Like, we were speculating about things last week. They got, like, immediately answered. I feel like Romeo, like we said, oh, maybe, like, he and Drea are working together, like, on the side. Like, no, like, she's out. And, like, to really control so much of Ika and then to it devolve to the point that it has so quickly, it's hard to watch. And I do think he should have been the target here. And at least he wasn't, but I don't know how much of that is on him. It actually seemed like he was going to play himself out of the game at a point. And it really was like the Mike and Chanel thing. But I do think he should have been the vote. And I think for both High and Mike, I mean, I have to credit Mike's amazing social game every week. You can see like the active social game. He said, yeah, I'm curious. Sure. He's curious about people. He uses that to connect. Like, it's a social game that deserves more than the 40s. That's what I'm like. He would be an amazing old school player, particularly in seasons or even Australian Survivor, where like that socialness is paramount. So I want to credit that. But I do think, like, you know, High has Chanel. Like, Chanel's relying on High, who's with Mike to a degree. I feel like it's all very one-sided coming from Mike, you know, like how upset he is about it. So, like, maybe it's better for Mike. But, like, for his alliance with High, I don't know that Chanel is a better vote. For the majority, I don't think that Chanel is a better vote. And he's, like, really going out of his way to take her out on this, like, personal grievance. And then, like, High switching to Romeo. Again, I like that move. Like, I think that's the right instinct. But I think, like, all the reasons he gives, while they are legitimate, like, he should have done that earlier on. Like, Romeo bringing chaos is totally fair. But, like, at that point, it's too late. Like, there's 30 minutes left. It feels like this is, like, a very stressful vote. Like, I don't know that the distinction between Chanel and Romeo necessitated, like, how much work High and Mike both seem to be putting into this compared to, like, someone like Omar, who's just like, yeah, whatever. So I don't know that I, like, really back either of the way that they were going about it. And I wanted to ask you as well, where do you feel like Roxroy fits into this? Because we got like little parts of it, but they're like, oh, we don't want to put off Roxroy. Like, he's obviously an old school player. They've already told him Chanel. I wonder if like Roxroy, is he like trying to protect Romeo to a degree with that Ika connection? I'm not sure, but I feel like Roxroy is more imperative to this than you would think Roxroy would be. Like, it seems pretty clear that he did vote incorrectly last week because he's like clearly part of the majority. He voted for Lindsay, who's in the majority. Like, it really starts to feel like he just made the mistake and he's like in this group. It seems like in somewhat of an integral way.
I will say the following. We've spoken a lot about all the people. The Vati tribe, original Vati and the green people, they've only got two people left, High and Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And what often happens in Survivor is you want to try to at least keep like some kind of an equilibrium between, you know, the different tribes or the different alliances, or whatever. So I don't foresee High or Mike being, obviously, I don't foresee them being in trouble because I think the majority will say, okay, well, we need to at least now either consider this orange faction between, you know, Jonathan, Lindsay and Omar, who might be gaining some traction. And on the other side, you know, Tori is also a bit of an enemy to Roxroy, so they've got the tension there. So I anticipate that it'll be, like I said, depending on how this tribal council plays out or what the format is for the double elimination, I think there are going to be people who is slowly but surely going to turn inwards. And I think, with that being said, we've seen Romeo being on his own. We've seen Dre with all the ammunition trying to say, well, I just want to stay out of a conflict as long as possible. Tori is a wild card. So I can think that Roxroy might just be by the default blue if they need to, you know, make a decision to vote out and one of them. That's my instincts or my sense of the game. If I was in the game, that's something I would be concerned about. And I think he might just be the because I don't think if his name is on the block or if he realizes the target's coming to him, I don't A, think he's got the social skills to try and move it around. And B, I don't think he doesn't have any ammunition or tools except for winning the immunity necklace to essentially keep himself in the game and try to create chaos. So I don't think he's played himself into a strong enough position to, if it's a small pocket of people and they decide to target him, that he can swap that to somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely can't. Like, we definitely see, like, even in the background, the missteps of this episode is so funny to me. Like, you know, I love the Rox-Tori dynamic. And, like, we didn't even get to see them talk, but it just was hilarious to me that in his old school way, he told Tori the plan. I thought it might come back on him in this episode. That, like, Rox-Tori said that? Because, like, he's going to give the plan and, like, not have the subtleness. And then for Tori to, like, for her to immediately sell him out and tell Romeo, it's very much like the scorpion and the frog between the two of them. I'm like, why would you even tell Tori that of all people? Like, you wouldn't tell Tori anything. Really confused about how that even happened. But I think, like, he could be part of what we see maybe next week. Like, it's going to be a guys' alliance. And if that happens, then we have to have the conversation again about guys' alliances. I may quit. This might be my last podcast. But I think that, like, there's a solid guys thing with Mike and Jonathan. And, like, Mike and High, I think, are the nexus of a lot of power, even if I don't agree with, like, how much they were doing in this episode. Like, they're central. Jonathan's in with that. Like, I think Rox could default become part of that, just because I don't know that he's going to become, like, a clear target. And he's also not on the outs. So definitely some really interesting dynamics with that. What do you feel of Mike generally? Like, I know you like the move, but what are you thinking about, like, where he's sitting in the tribe?
I think Mike has played an exceptional game. I think it's always difficult coming in, being the older person, being, you know, not necessarily as super athletic to be able to win challenges. And I think he has connected really well with people. It reminds me, I haven't seen I can't remember. I think it was perhaps Tony's deep dive, Tony Vlachos after Winners at War, when he said, like, he doesn't know anything about sport. He doesn't know anything about being, you know, young, always kids. But the one thing he knows is being able to chat to people about their families and just being able to connect with them on a human level. And that's all he did. He just kept speaking to people and having these conversations about their private lives, about the kids at home and what's happening. And if you win the money, what are you going to do? You know, just those, like, normal everyday to day stuff and connecting on a personal level. And that is an extremely disarming move if that is the perception you have, because obviously it takes time to build those relationships with people. And Mike has done exactly that. We've seen him so many times have his conversations with people about, you know, religion or growing up or their families. And we've heard people saying, like, Mike is the big father figure in the group. So if you have that kind of relationship and now suddenly, you know, there's rumors of this guy might have an idol or that guy might have an advantage or there's an underground thing or people are, I don't know, wait, that's the last person you're like, oh, well, you know what, let's throw that out the window and vote out Mike tonight. That's not going to be the first instinct that comes up in your mind, you know? So if you have that connection with the people, you need to get all the way to the end, or you can get it to the end. The only potential problem with that is, and this is depends on how Mike handles, you know, these next couple of votes, is you can get to the end in a way that Chrissy got to be in the recent Australian Survivor, where it's like, yeah, sure, we all had nice chat about our kids, but what did you do in the game? I think that might be – so if he can do that and sit at the end and say, well, these are all the great moves I made at the right time, instead of just saying, well, I was a fun guy to be around, but I didn't really, you know, had an impact on the game, I think that's his big you know, the hurdle he has to cross. But I think he's in an excellent spot, much better so than somebody like Rox-Tori, who – at times, I feel like, you know, he's struggling to see the wood from the trees, you know. He can get all into these all, like, trivial fights with people. I think Mike is much better at understanding people and connecting with them on a human level, for sure.
Yeah, like, Rox-Tori, I don't think is seen as a threat. And you could almost pencil him in for the end, unless he, like, loses a fire. But I just don't see it as a winning game, obviously. But I don't see when you would take him out, because he's not just, like, a buffer vote of the people on the outs, and he's never going to be a threat. For all the reasons that Mike should be a threat, because I think he is so social, he is so liked, I think he does have a strong winner chance. And I think that he could point to strategy, like if he drove home this vote, sorry if I keep saying drive home, but we're in a car. and, you know, the way that he even, like, bounces back from the Jenny vote by being with High, like, I think that it's not just social, like, he's amazing socially, but it's also the social strategy, and I think that he could point to that. You know, whether the jury feels again in an Oma way, like, hard done by, because it was so connected socially and it was personal and it was, like, you know, this emotional thing. And that's probably why he reacts to the Chanel thing. Not that it's not hypocritical, but, like, he invests in people socially. So if he gets burnt by it, it hurts. And in the same way, they might feel burnt by him. So it's definitely an interesting thing. where I think there's extreme winner potential, but I think also they should start looking at him like he's a threat because he's sitting in a very good spot. I want to ask you about the negotiation before we move on to the chizzy.
Negotiations.
What do you think about what do you think about this? Did Jeff win this negotiation? Are we enjoying the now twice used Rice negotiation of people sitting out of a challenge for this?
I will say this. As a player, it's always fun to negotiate with the host or try to, you know, have the interactions. I think Nico's not always that keen on it. In one supply, so I think on the one endurance challenge, I was like, Nico, okay, it's been 2 hours. There's 5 of us left. You bring us some water and I'll step down. And he's like, just goes, no. Missed an opportunity for them to make a bit of a TV moment. But no, I always enjoy it when there's like a bit of back and forth. And also I like it because whenever there's a setup challenge, whether it's like this instance where you have to, you know, set out for greater good for the tribe or for, you know, personal reward, like, you know, sitting out for food or whatever, I think it also sends a message to the people who's left in the game. Like, okay, well, these are the people who's willing to compete. These are the people who think they're in a good spot. So I like it when things like this happen because it's almost like it's a very great non-verbal communication, essentially, where you can, you know, say where you feel you are in the game without saying where you're feeling you are in the game. So that's great. The only thing that I'm always concerned about is it's obviously a high risk play because you know potentially risk being able to compete in a challenge, but at the same time you also need to look at the challenge and think, do I realistically have a chance to win against the other team? Some people are always competing, saying, oh, I need to do this because I need to show my family that I'm competing. And then I go like in 2 minutes. I'm like, okay, but you could have had food. Why? What point are you trying to prove? But we've also seen it backfire. I mean, you think back. I think it was it Brenda in France's favorites, where she gave up the love my visit so that everybody could see their families on the boat, and then they voted out the next time. You know, the next night, because that's just, if you sit with that at the end, it's an immediate win. So people see that as a massive, you know, threatening move. Even though it might just be a humane interaction, not necessarily a gameplay move. So, yeah, there is downside. And I actually, this is something that I've spoken about, not a lot, but there is a bit of an unwritten rule within the game of Survivor with regards to everybody needs to essentially contribute to the camp life. Everybody needs to help build the shelter, because it's very easy to not do that and spend all your energy only to win the game or win the challenges, but you never contribute to camp life. I think you also lose the respect of the players. I'm trying to think of an example. I think in our season, like a guy like Durao, I think not necessarily because of the way he played, but there were lots of times when it was raining or we'd build a shelter and Durao would just sit there doing nothing. And I think it loses people's respect. So if you don't go out and hunt and go out and contribute, it breaks the overall impression of what people have on you. You know, it definitely, you know, brings that down. So if you make a move like this, you say, well, you know, I'm willing to do that for the tribe. I think it, once again, people are like, okay, well, this guy, you know, he will at least, it's almost like that quote unquote contribute to camp life kind of perception that you build if you pull a stunt like this. I just feel like if I was there and we had negotiations and Jeff said, okay, we are down for four people are in, that's it, and I'm one of the final four, I would say, Jeff, if we give you four, can the four of us then still get our own individual? Because he was saying you get an individual like a cup size, you know? I'd be like, okay, Jeff, well, you've gotten your four. Can we at least then get that for ourselves? You know, throw the negotiation back to Jeff. You've got nothing to lose. Maybe they did. But I feel like Jeff, they got a number that missed out. But I would have just been like, okay, well, now we've got something. Can we get something more? I would have, like, you know, foot on the gas. No pun intended on the comment, of course, but like, I would be driving that negotiation all the way to the end until there's no juice left to squeeze. And they were like, okay, well, okay, you know, let's give up. But, no, it was cool. And I always enjoyed it. I know some of the people think it's gimmicky and, you know, they don't like Jeff breaking the fourth wall, speaking to the camera. Okay. You know, telling us what he's planning. But, I think it was cool.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of crazy that Jeff would take time out of this episode to talk to future players to, like, threaten them for a future negotiation. Like, I didn't have that much time, Jeff. Like, you're talking to, like, what, like, 20 future people, 20, how many thieves I'm going to do it? You know, 18, 36, I don't know. But, okay, you like, took the time to do that. I actually will tell the future players right now how to win this negotiation because, like, what you're saying, okay, I would try to take everything out. Jeff actually has less leverage here. Like, I know that the players really, really want food. But, like, Jeff really, really wants it to be a good TV moment. So I think the players have, like, a lot of leverage here. All you have to do is George Costanza it, right? Famous Seinfeld thing. George says, yeah. If you want to act like you're really busy at work, just act really annoyed all the time. So, like, if people walk past your office and you're like, oh, they're like, wow, that guy's, like, clearly invested in some sort of problem that he's dealing with. And I think that principle applies here. Like, if you just act like it's really, really hard. Like, if four people put their hands up, like, yeah, I'll sit out. Then he wants 5 or 6. But exactly. It's because three people are like, yeah, I'll do it. And they have to, like, fight, and Marion has to cry for the last one that Jeff is happy with 4. So if two people next time put up their hand like, oh, yeah, that's fine, and then they all have to, like, get in the huddle for the third, and this person's like, oh, I'll do it, and Omar has his emotional moment, then Jeff will accept 3. Like, just give him the moment, the TV moment, that he wants. I mean, we like seeing the players get decisions, so I like that part of it. I'm always happy to see, you know, when it's more like, I'm bringing out nachos. Like, I love that kind of classy part of Survivor. I find that really fun. But I think, like, the 40s are meant to be like, we're not having fun. We're not getting nachos. Like, you get your, you know, bad PB.
The monster will never give you a treat. What kind of monsters are your scary movies?
Whereas, like, I enjoy watching the players, like, get a fun auction or whatever, like, when they've been deprived of things. That's meant to be a fun part of Survivor. But this is, we're going to have, like, a very dry negotiation about this. And I guess that's more fun TV because they're suffering more. But anyway, still like watching them get decisions, especially because I feel like this decision, as you're saying, like, we do see into the players. We see into every single player. Like, Omar, so clear to his game, those social connections, doing it for Marianne, connecting across the aisle for her. Lindsay, she's the first one to say it. She explicitly says, there are people here who haven't eaten. She makes it external. She's such a social player in that way. Versus Drea's, I need to eat. That comparison is so funny to me. And she's not even going to pretend that this is a social move. Like, she really wants the rice. But I really, really loved it for Marianne. Because as you're saying, we do sometimes see it go badly. We see people give things up and then get voted out. And I think that's actually more dangerous for people who are in power. Drea has a lot of protection. But say like, okay, oh, actually, Drea's vulnerable right now. She actually has not competed in an individual challenge yet. She's a strong player. She might start winning. Maybe if they want to flip things, they will vote Drea out even though she's given stuff up. Like, maybe if we're really doing, like, a whole big flip move. Versus Marianne, who's already on the bottom, no one's doing a big move to get her out. Like, she would just be the name of several names who are not in power. She knows that her name's not going to be in contention when there are other options on the bottom to get rid of who didn't sacrifice today. So then, like, we have heard her name. We kind of hear it a bit after, but, like, her name really wasn't as much in the mix, it seems, anyway. It was really like Tori, Chanel, and Romeo, but she really becomes like a non-factor to the vote because she sacrificed. So it's that implicit immunity. She says in a secret scene that she needs immunity, but she's bad at balance. Here's a way to get immunity without having to balance. They're not going to vote her out when she sacrificed, because why? It's not a big move. It's not a slip. And there are many other options, even with Tori winning immunity, who are people on the bottom who can go home. So to eke out that implicit immunity and save her trinkets for another round, I thought that was a great move from Marianne. And it's, again, what we speak to of making these small moves that you can on the bottom, these good social reads, her own self-awareness, like, you know, really hyping up that emotionality because she's so aware of herself, and really just, yeah, utilizing that, which I think was really, really cool. And I think worked as a social strategic move. So I love this move for her. And I do like when the show gives players the opportunity to make decisions that we can then analyze, yes. Even when it's just a strange negotiation that Jeff is, yeah, continuing to hammer home. But I really like this move for Marianne.
Yeah, I liked it. Like you rightfully say, we can analyze it. I think as soon as you have to analyze something or think about it on your commute or while you're jogging, if you think like, who else would have done it? Would I have done it? Then you've created a great moment, because then it keeps the viewers like engaged and you know, like I say, it implies a lot and indicates a lot without necessarily, you know, it's a show don't tell kind of concept where, you know, you show your intentions in the game when you make a move like that. And so I enjoy it always. I love it.
Yeah. Should we start rewarding some of these moves, Chizzy?
Can I? I've got one last thing that I want to discuss before we do jerseys, if we may, mm-hmm. if we may yes. Just push that out for a short while. I want to chat to you about two things, if we may. The last things in my notes. Second to last one, I'll save the best for last. I see that I've written here as well. Oh, okay. This is not what I'm, something I was talking about. I'm just reading here. Was this the first time we've heard the word calculus used in an episode of Survivor? It is not something I would have ever predicted. Not in a million years. What a great confessional from Mike saying, I'm not a brain surgeon. I don't know calculus, but I'm street smart. I was just blown away. And I got like four people tweeting me like, did you see how nerdy these guys are talking about calculus on Survivor? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just that it's something I don't think I've ever seen or would have expected. Okay, but that's not my point. My point, now that I've got my notes all sorted out. Shannon, what did you think of Drea having to be caught red-handed trying to get an advantage next mm-hmm. to the water well?
Yeah, I was going to get to this in the questions because we got a lot of rich facts said. Well, we'll do it now. He said, who wore better Jacques in the purple paint or Drea in the red paint? Mike, blue mask. We need Jacques tips on how Drea could have gotten rid of that paint. I love the paint stuff. It was very Macbeth, something we've spoken about a lot on the podcast recently, to the point where she was like, I need to get this red stuff off. I'm like, actually, the line is out, damn spot, Drea. But, you know, I get that you're modernizing it. That's great. I thought this was really fun. Like, I thought it was fun to put her by the well, which is a place where she's not doomed. Like, she can wash it off, but she's also scared she doesn't do it perfectly. Like, that's the exact thing they want. They don't want to come back, like, covered in red paint like she's in the Carrie movie. But they want her to not be able to fully wash it off because she's scared that she's going to get caught and one person sees it. And now, like, Tori has this thing over it, her, which is, yeah, perfect. Literally, they couldn't have scripted it better for Tori, of all people, to have that information. So yeah. I think that it worked really well. And I think that the exploding ink idea of advantages has been something that people have kind of thought about as a good idea for a while. And like, look, season 42 in the 40s, it's silly, you know, it's a silly game. It is, but we are embracing it. And I think this really worked as a mechanism of beware.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love it. I think it is such a fascinating, because I mean, how many ways can you penalize people that still in the game? You can take away their vote. I mean, that's something that's been done too. You know, if you want to do this, you can't vote. I mean, that's what Immunity Island was all about in season 8. So I think it's difficult for producers to come up with a way to have a kind of a, because I always feel if there's an advantage, there should be a trade-off, right? Or some kind of a risk that you have to take. I love it. Like, I'm almost feel like there should be no freebie in Survivor. If you want like an advantage, there's something you should get up. So this is such a brilliant thing that they've done now. So I love that. I just feel, and maybe this is just me, maybe I think probably the only person who would potentially agree with me is somebody like Anela or Chappies, but I think that she missed an opportunity to use that to send people on a goose chase. I mean, she has access to that red paint. The thing is there. I mean, that like whatever like steel cylinder that they sunk in the ground, it's going to be there, right? Or maybe they'll take it out later on some trip or mm-hmm. overnight or whatever, but she could have now taken a paintbrush or somewhere and pointed an arrow to that thing somewhere, like left a clue with it, and put like a fake idol with a fake note or whatever in there, and like completely added another like, what the hell is going on, you know, moment to the game. And she absolutely missed it. Like, okay, well, I got it, cover my tracks, okay, bye, I'm out of here, you know, that are the end. I would have definitely, definitely considered ways to either con people directly that they know it's me, or indirectly, you know, left some kind of a landmine there and see, you know, drop a bit of bait and see, you know, what fish you can catch with a stunt like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think like in her archetype of playing, like creating fake idols is definitely part of that. Because again, like that could be antisocial, but it's fun and it's big and it's advantage based. So that should work with like the framework that she has. But I also think like the nervousness when you have paint on your arm and you're just trying to escape, like she couldn't even properly clean it off. Like her time was spent trying to clean it. So yeah, I mean, it was a really, really fun one.
That was really fun. I mean, I don't know what
strange.
Type of, also straight. Yeah. I don't know what type of paint that, the paint that we had was, I think it was like 12-year guarantee of roof paint that they put on our cars. And also, I think there's a difference between washing it off your arm versus washing it off from a, you know, thick bush of hair. But it was great. It was great.
You are so ahead of the curve. Like, if you ever came across a paint advantage, And then you were covered in paint. You were already covered in paint because you covered yourself in paint. So there you go. Like you've already protected against it before. That's the solution to this. Like, oh, how do I deal with possible paint beware advantages in the future? Just be covered in paint to begin with. That's what you do.
Look, I'm going to tell you something. This is mega hearsay, but it's something I want to mention to you. When obviously I told you I knew Renier from their season, and I started talking to some other people from their season, just like, you know, building relationships and friendship, whatever, Santini, Renier, those kind of people. And I think when that episode happened in season 8, where they had to also, you know, do the paint thing, and I think half a cast, maybe more of them, like, send me messages, like, either they, like, what's up there? They phoned me, or they, like, you do not understand what happened. We had to do this paint challenge, and then LaRue comes up and he's like, okay, guys, listen to me. This is not going to be the same fiasco we had last season. Nobody's going to do a jog and throw the shit in the air. You take it, put it on your clothes, you put your hand in your pocket, that's it. Are we all in agreement? I don't want any monkey business, I want nothing. So a lot of, so many people told me that, so yeah, you want to leave a legacy. If you want to leave a legacy, make sure that producers warn people about, you know, doing the antics that you did from a TV
perspective. Yeah.
So yeah, there's a bit of a behind the scenes tidbit. Yeah, and then, I don't know, it's one last thing. I don't know if we have time, Shane. I want to chat to you about the shot in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear what's your opinion on that. I don't think I've ever spoken to you about shot in the dark in detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fine. Like, it's probably one of the things I feel most neutral about, where I appreciate that it gives people a chance, but they need, like, the perfect read to do it, and it's only 1 in 6, so they don't have much of a chance, versus the fact that it means people have to blindside better. I think it should stay at 1 in 6 because I don't want it to be more impactful. Like, people are saying, well, it's not working because it's not hitting. Yeah, but it's giving them a shot. That's meant to be the point. Like, it's working when they have a chance. That, to me, is the effectiveness of shot in the dark. It's not working, you know, only if it ever hits. So I think it's fine on 1 in 6. Seems like a small thing, and it's something that people have to play around. I mean, the biggest success of shot in the dark is that Chanel threw her vote to protect against shot in the dark, and Mike could not get past that. Like, those are the social ramifications that make mechanisms in the game interesting. So that, to me, is fascinating. So even if you say it hasn't hit, okay, but it's been impactful in other ways, and that, to me, is just as interesting, if not more interesting, than just like a 1 in 6 chance coming off.
Yeah. Okay. Can I, like, I, this is now a US thing, so we can't repurpose it. I can't find out about this, but I have a better implementation of shot in the dark. Can I pitch this to you, and then we wrap the soundbite and send it directly to Jeff and
mm-hmm. My direct line.
People who work at CBS. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we see two things happen. We see on one side fans complaining about being deep in the game and there's begonging, and, you know, if you're in a minority, you don't always have a way to bail yourself out. And then they say the show gets boring. That's the one side, which always comes up season after season. And on the second side, you have people who have a lot. It's been like one of these themes that people have proposed for many years, saying everybody should start the game with an idol. You know, everybody should start the game with this one thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then either you know, maybe it's like a coin they had in Winners of War, or maybe they have like some kind of two idols you bring. And so it's something that I know people have spoken about a lot when going on this round. Okay. I say you bring shot in the dark in, and you say the game begins. Everybody gets this dice, whatever you want to call it, trinket, shot in the dark thingy, but instead of 1 in 6, you can start, and this can vary from season to season, but let's just say it starts at 1 in 8, okay? It starts at 1 in 8. If somebody plays a shot in the dark, 1 in 8 chance, if they fail and the guy goes home, the next instance it's 1 in 7, and then mm-hmm. 1 in 6, and 1 in 5. So it has this, like, appreciating odds of the, when it will actually happen, right? So it's not like it, and so deeper into the game, and then it becomes like 1 in 2 or X amount of people who play the, you know, final one. So let's say 5 people play it and it's 1 in 2, then, you know, they'll like draw rocks, like 1 in 5, whichever gets it, you know. So it's 1 in 2 or X, whatever amount of people play it. I think, and then once it hits, it's done. It's retired. It's end of the season, done. It's gone. You go home. Because I think a lot of time people that know they'll be out, they might as well try it. You know, 1 in 8 is not going to hit, but it's slowly going to, you know, bring it down to a point where, like, I mean, now it's probably going to happen. And I'm not an actuary. I can't tell you the exact stats of if you do a decreasing thing where it will hit eventually. But I think that way, people will start, and now it becomes there's six, seven people left in the game, a 3-3, a 2-2. Oh, but there's a shot in the dark. This guy's going to idle. It just adds like another layer of it's luck, but it's managed luck. If that makes sense, it's not true randomness. You can actually like game theory it out to plan for that. And I think that way it'll always give that underdog a way out of a game, and it will tell them the majority will always have to think of that. So now they need to start splitting votes or you know, like you rightfully said, you know, people have to now save their votes, split votes. And then you might run into scenarios like we had in our season where Steph is not sure what's going on. So somebody can slip through the radar because they made a play, because there was some confusion created. So I think it has potential with like one small tweak to be a staple that's just been the game forever.
But I feel like I'm the strongest advocate of the 1-6 than maybe anyone in the world. Like, I have heard, okay, well, maybe you should appreciate. Firstly, I do think that's pretty hard for the viewers to follow, as if this game isn't hard and confusing enough when people have paint beware advantages. I mean, that's a silly part. But, like, who has what and how many advantages? Like, it is hard for the casuals and even sometimes the super fans. Like, there's a lot going on to remember, like, at what point we're at. There's a lot of math for the players to be doing, which I enjoy. And I like that. Not that it's too complicated, but I like that the players are then making different decisions, holding on to it, that they're rewarded for being able to stay in the game longer. You're penalized for needing it earlier. You have a worse shot. I think that that's fair in a social strategy game, that you should be penalized for being on the outs earlier. Or, I don't know, I mean, there are parts of that demographically that have been hard, but like, hopefully we're at a point where that's on you and now you only have a 1-8 chance. So I like parts of that, but I actually feel like the 1-6, I don't have any complaints with the way that Shot in the Dark is working. Like, it's not hugely affecting things in ways that the whole game is upended. And I don't know that I ever want it to be, you know, get down to the 1-3, 1-2. Like, I'm fine with it being 1-6 and the decisions players have to make. And I think there are a lot of decisions in playing it. There are decisions around what we've asked the whole season. Like, should you throw your vote? Look what happened to Chanel when she chose. Like, that socialness versus, you know, the impact something like Shot in the Dark can have only on the 1-6, like that subtle pressure of only 1-6 versus like, it, you know, it's not an extreme pressure, but it's still a little scary. I actually think that's been working really well. It's interesting because the other day I was watching AFL, and the point of AFL is that if you get a goal, 6 points, and if you get a behind, it's 1 point. So it's literally a 1-6 of that. And I said to my brother, I'm like, this is like the Shot in the Dark, because that's like a perfect number, 1-6, because the behinds, no one celebrates when you get a behind. Like, you want a goal. 1-6 is not good, but they can also make the difference. Like, you can win the game by 1 point. So it's actually like, again, like this perfect formula of 1-6. And that's what I feel the Shot in the Dark is. I actually feel like it's the perfect number. I think there are still tons of decisions between that socialness and the metric, and the mechanic of that. And I also feel like, you know, Romeo, for example, like, he can play Shot in the Dark, but then if he's wrong and he's not the primary, he's wasted it for the future. So there's still a lot of decisions to be made. And I think that subtle pressure for me is working well. Like, I don't feel like I need it to appreciate, because then I feel like it will become this really central part of the game, where I'm enjoying the way that it acts on the sidelines, and one day it'll hit and that will be pretty exciting. And I feel okay with it, but I definitely hear your point. I know a lot of people want it to appreciate. And I think that that's a different thing. Like, that's a big part of the season to me. Like, that's something they always have to be thinking about. Like, how much are you keeping it, and at what point in the game are you going to use it? Because that becomes more powerful. So obviously it's a bigger part, I think, of the season. But just kind of having it in your pocket to probably not work, but maybe it will, for me, is fine for where it stands in the game.
Sure. I mean, maybe it just gets like 2 seasons back to back, you know.
When season 43 is just like a perfectly fine season, but then season 44 is like an homage to season 43. What we have now, then we'll see it back to back. But let's start rewarding the players with a chippy. Take it away, Jake. Yes. Take a wide scene and MC Color.
1, 2, 3.
All right, Jacques, can I request that you go first? Because I might be willing to change my points based on what you do. Because it's someone I haven't given points to that I feel like deserves points. And if you don't give them points, I might. So I need you to go first, because I'm still kind of calculating. I know that that's not strictly kosher, but I probably keep it as it is. But like, I'm a little torn this week.
Well, man, now I'm disciplined. I'm not a lawyer or something. I'll try advocate, so I can try and swear you. That's not my speciality, Shannon. But I will go first. You know, I love giving out some points or chizzy points. That's the reason why I went on the show, to be able to be a chizzy point adjudicator. okay. By the way, I never asked you. When you did your thing with Rob, I heard that they played my message saying, you know, that you to actually allocate jersey points of Rob. So yeah, it's the first time I sent a voice note that time, probably only time. And I heard they played it. Cool.
That's very cool. I mean, you are a guest on this podcast. You also played Survivor. I'm glad that like getting a feedback question on the show can still be a little bit of a thrill.
Yes. It was a big thrill. It's one of the highlights of my life. Being able to be part of this community. Okay. I have in third place, I have Tori. And this, I don't know, some people are very low on her, but I think Tori has done a fantastic job of still being in the game by winning two immunities, which is not something that we see people do often. I mean, winning an immunity challenge alone is difficult. Winning two back-to-back has been fantastic, you know, the first two of the season. And that after you mentioned it briefly, that interchange with Thraya was just being able to like, hey, what's happening? Like, I see something, I'm going to keep an eye on it. I don't know if it's foretelling something or if it's just a random piece of information, but I think like Tori has, I think if you take it back to episode one or two and you would make predictions, who makes the merge or who gets to final 10, I don't think people would have had her in the, had her on that list. So the fact that she's still here, I think it's great. Third. So that's at 1 point for Tori, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Second, I'll say Drea. For the reasons we spoke, she got the, you know, she sat out, she got the advantage, she's still sitting on four of them. She got semi-caught with her hand in the cookie jar. She didn't get caught with the cookie, but she got caught with the breadcrumbs. So I'll have Drea second. I don't want to get too much. We spoke a lot about her. And then firstly, I will say Mike, for his great, you know, his ability to build these social connections. And then finally getting rid of, I'm going to say a nemesis, but a thorn in his side that's been bugging for a while. I think Mike has done a fantastic job to be in the game without being a threat. I think he's done an exceptional job of his name is not once that I've heard got thrown around. He's still sitting on an idol, which could potentially be well. And I think that he is playing a fantastic, not necessarily, you know, flashy game, but I think he's doing well with, I will say, an honorable mention to Omar. I think Omar did well in the last two rounds to control the vote and make sure he's got, knows what's happening. But I think Tori, Drea, and Mike, in this instance, sweeps the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. That gives me questions in other ways, which I'll explain. I mean, the point for Tori is really interesting. She does catch Drea out in a conversation that I thought was hilarious because Tori has to be like fake concerned, like, oh no, the paint got everywhere. And Drea has to be like, yeah, be careful about that. The runny.
Well, what the worst warning ever? Like, be careful about the paint. It spreads.
What? Yeah. She's basically LaRue. Like, be careful. Don't do too much of it. But this is why you were ahead. Because imagine if Tori could be like, are you covered in paint? And Drea could be like, yeah, I'm always covered in paint. So this is an emergent strategy, but if the producers allow you being always covered in paint, I definitely think that's an interesting point. And yeah, she caught her out, and I don't think that she was like too harsh about it. Like, she still tried to act like, oh, I believe you, Drea. And then she goes and tells Marianne, and we see there's a secret scene where she and Marianne seem to have a really nice bonded relationship that's not making the airtime as much. You've seen the conversations, but they seem to really get on in the secret scene. So definitely some stuff there. Okay. So I'll give a point to Marianne based on the move to sit out, which I loved, and getting that implicit immunity. It's predicated on great awareness, and it's just a great individual one-episode move. This is where I felt I got confused, because I'm definitely giving 3 points to Omar. I'm going in the rare 1-3-2 direction, because the two is what confused me. I knew I wanted to give one to Marianne because I felt like that deserved a point. 3 points I want to give to Omar because I do love the way he's playing the game, connecting further, someone like Mike as well. Like, he uses that lack of vote to help him keep him hidden. Like, that's what I love. Like, you talk about, you know, recruiting mechanisms. He didn't even have something, and that's a benefit to his game. And I know that it's building off last week where he got 3 points, but I just love the way that he's going about it. And even to be, you know, compared to Rob Sestanino, like, by Rob, like, what a compliment. And I just feel like the options and the potential in that, and like sitting out as well to advance his cause, like, it's all contributing to what I think is like a really well-rounded game. And even if I don't know if that's what the modern game requires, it's a game that I love. So I have to give it points. And then the 2 points I was struggling because I wanted, like, you know, 2 points to Drea. I wanted to give for succeeding in the framework she's given herself, for getting knowledge of power, which is so crucial to that. There are some social missteps and missed opportunities. I definitely think had she set out to get the advantage of the reward challenge, like not for the PB&J reason, and also if she'd like sat out for whatever reason she wanted, but like at least tried to pretend she was doing it socially, I might have liked that a little bit more. But she can't be doing much better than this style of game, so I will give her 2 points, which makes her win the Chizzy this week. I don't know how I feel about her getting the most points this week. I don't know if I can say that she was the best, but she gets 4 points this week from the two from us. The one that I'm not giving to, obviously, is Mike. And that's someone, if you didn't give him any points, I might have had to switch. Like, I'll give him the honorable mention because, obviously, he's so central, so social. How can we, you know, not give points? I literally have here, I hope Jacques gives him points.
So you've got one Mary Ann, two for Drea, three for Omar.
Because for Mike, I didn't love the Chanel move. I felt it was too personal. I felt that he was going out of his way, maybe unnecessarily, and I didn't even know if it's, like, the right move for him. So I didn't want to give him points for this episode for me, but I feel like where he's sitting in the game requires points. So I'm glad he got points and the 3 points from you. So that's enough for me to just stick with my original points and give to Oma, Drea, and Marianne in that order. And that means that Drea continues to lead on 16 points. Oma is now on 14 points. Hai is on 11. Mike is now on 10. Romeo's on 9. Jonathan 6. Lindsay 4. Marianne is now on 4. Tori is on 3, and then Daniel, Swati, and Jenny left on 2, and Lydia left on 1. So that's where we're at with the points. And the only one left in the game who doesn't have points is Roxroy. Yeah, he's the only one who doesn't. So, yeah. I don't know. I felt really torn because, again, it's just about, like, kind of building in this episode rather than the individual moves, even though I disagreed with Mike's moves. So it was hard to give points. But I feel like we got to, like, an okay place with it. Every, you know, Omar was doing well, Mike's doing well, Drea's doing well. They got points, and then Tori and Marianne on the bottom are, like, trying to progress in their own way in constricted positions, and they get a point each for that. We did okay with it, right?
Yeah, I think so. Coming in, Shannon, who was your winner pick? I don't know if
my winner pick was Omar. I continue to give him Chizzy points.
I say like, that sounds like being not very objective. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Who was your winner pick? Oh, you didn't do the preseason stuff.
Well, I went into the preseason, but after episode one, I said I'll take Lindsay off. Episode one, I think I enjoyed her, and then just, you know, after week one, just, you know, checking what people do on socials. Yeah, I think obviously we haven't seen a lot of her, which doesn't necessarily bode well. But I mean, last season we didn't see a lot about Erica until, you know, the home stretch. So, but yeah, I think she's also we haven't spoken a lot about Lindsay this episode, but I think it'll be interesting. I think next week she's going to be essentially forced into the limelight with the interest advantages or advantage amulets with the split coming up, because then, you know, you might be forced to play it. So we'll see how that pans out. Excited.
Yeah, I mean, she could get an honorable mention, I feel like, for those individual moves. Like, just the way she goes about the social moves, the fact that she's the first one in the negotiation, which, again, is not good for the negotiation itself. Definitely act like it's difficult. That's how you win the negotiation. But the fact that she can be like, I want, you know, people haven't eaten. I'm like, you're a social player. Like, you are thinking of others, and you're making that very, very apparent. So, yeah, very interesting to see that happen. But Jacques, where can people find you on social media to see if you're tweeting about the show? Lisa from last week, you know, she's really dedicated to this 12 days of Twitter thing, but tweeting every day. So if I can do one thing for the world, it's get my guests more dependent on Twitter, because she tweeted saying that, you know, she really missed it on Thursday when she couldn't go online. And I'm like, oh, now you're like the rest of us. You are dependent on this toxic product. You are welcome. So Jacques, maybe hopefully we don't put you in the same position, but where can people find everything?
I love Lisa. She's probably my New Zealander I've spoken to the most on social media, maybe the only one. Maybe one other.
Like New Zealand survivor or like New Zealand the person?
No, New Zealand survivor.
I don't know people in New Zealand. Now that I think about it. Not personally, at least. I mean, yeah.
Your 12-day challenge. Reach out more to more New Zealanders. Make some friends from New Zealand.
Well, if there's any New Zealanders in London, you know, come and get, definitely.
I'm trying to focus on this, international move that I did. I don't have time to just be like randomly.
Exactly. You can get me on Twitter at JoppyTweeting. I have not tweeted in a while purely because of the move to London. I always like to just give my, you know, Randy Bailey style, one sarcastic comment on each episode. Some people enjoy it, some people don't, but it's cool. But I haven't tweeted in a while. But if you are a Survivor fan, I am in dire need of friends in London. not dire, but if you have a braai, or as they call it here, barbecue. If you have a braai or a barbecue, and you would like to have two South Africans join, Hayden and I would be more than welcome to head out at night. It sounds extremely sad. but no, yeah. I'm on Zoppy Tweeter on Twitter, and then Instagram. You can just search me there, but it's mostly, I'll actually post a couple of London pictures now, I think about them on Instagram. So yeah.
Do it. Yeah.
I'm there as well.
Yeah. Well, Jacques, remember, like, if they don't invite you over, like, they might not be into you.
They might be intimidated, as I'm the best survivor currently in London. Yes. And if there's any other survivor people who want to challenge me, let's go for a street fight. I'm down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know that that's what we're endorsing, but maybe we should try and get Kira not to move to London. Because then there would be no question. And then you could keep the title forever. And that would be great. That's a good thing to have.
Thank you so much for having me. I always say this, but I know that year by year, your pool of people grows bigger. So I always appreciate when you ask me to join. It's always lovely. And I always have a blast chatting to Survivor with you. So, yeah, it's always great fun for me. And always a fun point in the season. I really enjoyed it. Again.
No, I always love chatting to you. And yes, there are a lot of great guests, and we've had many of them this season, and we'll continue to have great guests. But I do always love chatting with you because, you know, it just feels like chatting with a friend about something we both love so much and think about too much. And it's just always a good time. And I love this conversation and that it went from, you know, hate strategies to Sex in the City strategies to like actual thoughts on the game for sure. But always a great time. So thank you so much, Jacques. And next week I will have another friend. King George Mladenov will join me to talk about the Double Tribal Council, which we talked about last season. So
Yes. I will now give it to a more suitable guest. Yeah, George is fantastic. So I think he will have some great insights for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm excited to get his takes after all of talking tribal. We've obviously talked about a lot of Survivor together, but we'll be talking for the first time about this season. Speaking of Australian Survivor, deep dives continue. Five are out. So Nina and Khan were most recent, Sam, Mark and Chrissy from last week, and KJ still to come. So almost done with the content for that season. But thank you so much to everyone who's checking out all of that. I know it's a lot of hours of podcasting, and I really appreciate anyone who's checking out the content. Follow me at Shannon Gates. Subscribe to the International Survivor Hap-Up Speed so you don't miss any of that. But Jacques, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, truly, truly had a great time. Thank you to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Thank you to you all for listening in your cars. Hope you're having enjoyable drives. Hope you're whatever seat you're in. Hope you're not hanging onto the side, back seat, front seat, wherever you are.
And keep your seatbelt on.
Yeah, keep your seatbelt on for sure. You know, that's like the immunity of the car. You know, that's absolutely. And anyway, we have to finish the analogy, but I will see you guys next time. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Survivor.
21 South Africans, 12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
1 million pounds.
Million euro.
Million shekels.
Million rubli.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.